Then I'll call the meeting to order. It is 1:05 on March 16, 2016. And, oh, glasses. That's going to help. I can't read the public comment thing if I don't have glasses. Can we get the meeting call, the roll call then? Sorry.
Jim DeMartini?
Here.
Michael O'Neill?
Here.
Jeff Grover?
Here.
Donna Riley?
Here.
Mandeep Dillon?
Here.
Mike Lynch? Gordon Ford? Joan Clendenin?
Here.
Jason Gordo? Sam Sharp?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Excellent. Are there any announcements? Anyone? Public comment. Matters under jurisdiction of the board may be addressed by general public before or during regular agenda. However, California law prohibits the board from taking action on any matter which is not on the public on the posted agenda unless it is determined an emergency by the Board of Retirement. Any member of the public wishing to address the board during the public comment period shall be permitted to be heard by the board up to 3 minutes. Please complete a public comment form and give it to the chair of the board. That would be me. Any person wishing to make a presentation to the board must submit the presentation in written form with copies furnished to all board members. Presentations are limited to 3 minutes. I don't see any members of the public. So moving on, consent items. Any edits or anything that needs to be pulled?
I do have an announcement for a department change. Manuel Herrera is not with GSA, he is with HSA.
And you have, it's on the last one. No more.
Anything else?
That is correct.
Is there a motion to accept the consent calendar now with the edits?
Motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The item passes. So next up, LSV. I'm not seeing LSV here.
We are recording.
Oh. Excellent. Oh, excellent.
So we will call LSV now.
As a reminder,
Swami is our director of research and on the investment team. And on that note, we've had no changes to the team or the organization. See on page one, the ownership and the structure, no changes there. We added four new partners at year end, so every year end we reevaluate and add partners where we see fit, and four of the professionals in the different areas of the firm. Our main partner is Josh O'Donnell, who is our Chief Compliance Officer and Chief Legal Officer, who joined us 2 years back, was named a partner, as well as Titus Liu, who's on the investment team. He is a programmer and been with us for about 5 years. Brian Sanderson, who's on the trading desk, who does shares the trading responsibilities for your portfolio with Dan Newman. And then Marissa Rosenblatt, who works with the client service team, were the four that were named partners at year end. But as far as Swami and his team and Joseph and the portfolio management and research team, no changes to that group. As far as, just briefly on the first page, assets under management, we're at the end of February at just under $80 billion in assets. With about $16 billion in international large cap equities at both developed markets and, in your case, where we invest also in emerging markets with the ACWI ex-US benchmark. And last year, we had positive cash flows into the strategy, so some new business and cash flows from current clients. We saw most of the positive flows in our non-US business last year, but really not a whole lot of change to the client base or to kind of the assets and our under management and the strategies that you see at the bottom of the page. I touched on page two already. Again, no changes to roles and responsibilities on the investment team. So if there aren't any questions on the organization, I'll ask that you turn over to page six. On the presentation, we can jump into recent performance. So on page six, we have the market update with just the results for the indices, and this is going through the end of February for the year-to-date, and then annualized periods going back with the large cap benchmarks at the top of the page, small cap emerging markets, and then the comparative U.S. indices. A couple of points maybe to make before we talk about your specific performance. The environment for value stocks, and we're as you recall, we're a deep value investor, buy stocks that are cheap on multiple measures of value, price to cash flow, price to earnings, price to book, has not been too kind over the last year. And even when you look over the last 5 or 10 years, a little bit of a headwind. So you look at the one-year number, if you could, at the top of the page, and you see a big, some big negative numbers. So, non-U.S. markets, have struggled, and value stocks in particular. And we have a line there that says MSCI EV value versus growth spread, and that's just the difference between the benchmarks of growth stocks and value stocks. And when it's negative, value stocks have lagged. So, a bit of a headwind for us in the last, 2 years. Historically, that has not, been the case. We've just been in a period of time where some of the higher multiple stocks, in the U.S., it would be the Facebooks and the, Amazons and Google, but also outside the U.S., a similar kind of an environment. So, emerging markets, we have the other point on this page. We have about 20% of your portfolio in emerging markets, which is equal to the benchmark. We're not making a bet on emerging markets, but about 20% of your portfolio is invested in emerging markets. And last year, emerging markets were the weakest segment of the non-U.S. Markets. Interestingly enough, we've seen quite a little bit of a rebound, particularly this month in emerging markets. And if you look through, even yesterday or through Friday, they're actually either neutral or positive for the year. So they've rebounded about 6 or 7% just this month, as have the metal market. So we've seen a nice, you know, rebound, so the numbers don't look quite as negative when you, you know, roll forward through the first 2 weeks of March. But again, we're not taking a bet on emerging markets, but just to point out that has been an area of the markets that has struggled a little bit also.
Yeah, let me just add a couple points to that, is that when you look at the regions of the world, pretty much no region was spared in terms of the value struggle. Developed Europe, Japan, Asia-Pacific, ex-Japan, U.S., emerging markets, everywhere last year was a difficult year for value stocks. Japan, was also negative, not as negative as the other regions, but pretty much all the regions, it was a struggle for value, and the growthy stocks, especially in the U.S., the social media companies and so on, ran up quite a bit last year, but the struggle for value was fairly widespread across the various regions of the world.
So on page 7 is your performance, and we have made it through the end of February. So at the top of the page, you see the year-to-date number, which would be January and February, 1 year, 3 years, and going back to inception. Maybe if we could focus on 2015. We have a page on the next page on with some attribution, simple attribution on what happened in 2015. But it's this year. We've kind of in line with the benchmark, but in 2015, your portfolio was down 5.2, but net of fees down 5.8. So we're in line with the broad MSCI ACWI ex-US, so the core benchmark, which includes both value and growth stocks in there. But the value benchmark, as you see, was down 10.1. So we did quite a bit better than the value benchmark. Over time, we think we should add value to both of the core and the value benchmark. But in shorter periods of time, we're going to correlate more, and you're going to with the value benchmark. So we were about 4% better than the value benchmark, but about even with the core benchmark last year. So there were a few sectors of the market that we find expensive, healthcare. And consumer staples in particular, we're underweight those sectors relative to the core benchmark. So names like Unilever and British American Tobacco, we've talked about in past meetings, are still trading at pretty high prices. So that cost us a little bit not being overweight or invested in some of those names. But we made that up with decent stock selection in a number of areas, including financials, industrials, materials, some of these boring, out-of-favor segments of the market. So, last year, when you compare to a core benchmark, it was an okay year being in line, but kind of our universe of stocks that we pick amongst the value names, we were able to hold up a bit better than that. And again, year-to-date, whether you look at the first 2 months of this year, even fast forwarding to yesterday, we're a bit above the two benchmarks, which aren't too much different. Values coming back a little bit, particularly in this month. So we hope to see that trend continue.
Hey, Keith, can I stop? I have a question for you, and probably Ed as well. We look at several metrics here. When we look at LSP, and so I'm wondering if we should start looking at LSP relative to the MSCI value, because even this right here is based on just the MSCI and not the value part.
Right. We think over time that we should be able to outperform both of the benchmarks. The value benchmark is a little more appropriate from a characteristic standpoint. So if you look, I'm going to jump around a little bit, but not to get too far ahead, but if you look on page 9, you see the characteristics of our portfolio. Even though we're building the portfolio, with the kind of core benchmark in mind as far as how much risk and exposure we'll take to certain sectors, we're still going to be cheaper than the value benchmark. So we're a lot more like from a characteristic standpoint. Again, we're comfortable with either benchmark, but in shorter periods of time, we are going to correlate more with a value benchmark. So I don't know if you have any other thoughts.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, can start up a farm corn and grow, and that we just went through a period like that. But typically, those periods don't last forever, don't last long, and they tend to be a strong value recovery. And in those periods, value tends to outperform corn, and corn will outperform growth. And as deep value investors, we should outperform value benchmark, even in that, certainly in that environment, and for sure the core benchmark. So I think over the long run, the pattern one should observe is that our portfolio should outperform a value benchmark, and a value benchmark should outperform a core benchmark. I know that hasn't been the case in the last several years, but I don't think that's the trend that will continue going forward. So, you know, we're comfortable with either benchmark, but in the U.S., of course, it's much more customary to use a value benchmark for our portfolios.
Is the asset allocation decision and the decision to give money to LSV to actively manage predicated on a value philosophy?
So, not that I know of, so that was done prior, so yeah. I could go back and research that. I believe it was done on an Acquiex US basis, but we are seeing what LSV is saying is very common right now among the international value managers, because just the value tilt alone is so powerful in explaining the results right now. But as we see on page 5, the mandate is benchmarked to Acquiex US. So this is kind of the formal relationship summary that LSV is providing us. So I would continue to look at this as an Acquiex US mandate with the value tilt.
Okay, very good.
And similarly, the other Acquiex US manager we have here in our portfolio has a growth tilt. So we're kind of building it in that construct.
All right.
Any other questions on performance, either short or long, or expectations before we talk a little bit about how the portfolio is constructed?
I see none.
Okay. If not, I'll turn it over to Swami to talk a little bit about how the portfolio looks at this point and where we're seeing opportunities.
On page 9, we looked at it briefly. You see the valuations for the portfolio on various metrics, price to forward earnings, where forward earnings come from the consensus sell-side analyst forecast, the FY1, which is 1 year out, FY2 is 2 years out, forecast, price to cash flow, price to book. As you can see that on price earnings and price to cash flows, the portfolio trades at a deep discount to the MSCI Aggregate U.S. benchmark, and also at a discount to the value benchmark. And that's what deep value means. And what we are saying, finding, is that these valuations, especially because 20% of the portfolio is an emerging market have not participated in the rally that we have seen in the developed markets over the last 2 or 3 years. They look really cheap right now, and they've been cheap for quite some time. Even though emerging markets are expected to still grow at least twice, their economy is expected to grow at twice the rate of the developed market. The low valuation of the emerging market piece of the portfolio, as well as the value component, makes this portfolio very cheap right now. And we think that is a good characteristic to have. We're able to find attractive names, companies with strong cash flows and earnings at very low valuations, and that should obviously benefit the portfolio immensely over the next 3 to 5 years. And we're beginning to see some evidence in the U.S. and international markets since, I would say, mid-January, late January of a value turnaround, more so in the month of March, and we are all hopeful that will continue. So there are 3 things that favor value at this point. Obviously, the fact that value is underperformed, the mean reversion favors value. The valuation spread between value and growth, value has gotten quite cheap compared to growth, that is favorable. And historically, at least in the U.S., in a rising interest rate environment, value stocks have tended to do better. To the extent that U.S. Federal Reserve interest rate policies has global implications, we think that will also benefit value stocks internationally. So we think that the way the portfolio is structured, with attractive valuations, with a healthy dividend yield of 4.1%, compared to 3.3% for the core benchmark. All of that is favorable for the portfolio going forward. And, we're also finding, that the portfolio, because of its deep value nature, it tends to be a little bit smaller in market cap than the benchmark. You can see that in terms of the weighted average market cap and weighted median market cap. All those things in the long run are going to be, the next 3 to 5 years, I think will be very beneficial to this portfolio. If you jump to page 10, you see the current positioning of the portfolio in terms of the sector underweight and overweight. As we just discussed, the portfolio, even though it's a deep value portfolio, in terms of risk control, pressure constraints, industry constraints, position limits, are optimized to the core benchmark, because that's the benchmark that was provided to us. And you can see that with respect to the core benchmark, the portfolio is slightly overweight consumer discretionary, significantly underweight consumer staples, because, you know, companies like Nestle, Unilever are very expensive. We're basically neutral to energy. It used to be overweight energy maybe 3 years ago, but with a drop in earnings estimate for energy companies in general, especially integrated oil companies, we have reduced overweight energy. We are a little bit overweight in financial, underweight healthcare, which is another expensive area. So you can see that our constraints can be plus or minus 5% to sectors. So if you have a lot of attractive names, we could be max overweight 5%. If there aren't enough attractive names, say, for example, like in consumer staples, we could max underweight 5%. And you can see pretty much in every area, the constraints are well within the plus or minus 5% range. So even though we favor some sectors and don't favor other sectors, then the model is still able to find attractive names across a wide variety of sectors. And I don't think this positioning will change significantly over the next rebalances. We typically rebalance your portfolio, all our portfolios, once in 2 months. I expect the same patterns to continue over the next several months. And on page 11, you see that we're basically country neutral. Our weight to the emerging markets is roughly, is basically the same weight as the weight of the emerging markets in the benchmark. And we are, again, going to be within plus or minus 1%, 1.5% of the country weight. We are not taking any active country bets. I think those are very hard to do. We are focusing on bottom-up stock selection in every country, and that is what we are continuing to do. Let me just pause for any questions. The next page is pages 4 through 15, gives you some, 14 gives you the names and the holdings we have currently. But, you know, let me pause and see if you have any questions on the portfolio positioning.
So your objective of our portfolio, our investment, is to beat the benchmark by 200 basis points. Is that still relevant? Is that still relevant for you?
Traditional pattern of value or performing growth over long periods of time, we will be able to do even better.
else. All right. We appreciate it, gentlemen.
Thank you. And thanks for having us today. And we both look forward to talking to you in the future.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye now.
Did anyone have any questions about any of the LSV stuff?
Pardon me?
Did anybody else have any questions about the LSV stuff before we move on to PIMCO?
Just maybe just highlight this.
So this, what I see here relative to CI, not the value benchmark, is that they've actually, this correlates very well with how well they did relative to that benchmark. It's slightly under, and which is what their results show in their exhibits there. You can see one thing, you can see every June we have a catch-up in terms of, you notice that number that ends on June 30th for the last 2 years is somewhat larger than the others. This is one of our managers that's on a performance-based fee schedule. That explains that. But overall, if you look at the lower right chart, the cumulative value added, the LSV has added value over the last 5 years. Their results have been a little bit random, quarter by quarter, based on the left-hand side of the exhibit there. But again, LSV continues to add value, and they have added slightly over, almost $4 million over the last 5 years.
On an investment of?
On an investment of around $100 million, I believe.
Not much for a return.
What's that?
Not
well, that's value added above the benchmark. So
okay.
That's money we are getting in addition to what we would get with a passive investment.
And have we withdrawn funds
we
from
have,
that?
We have. If you want to look, it's on one of those first two pages in the exhibit.
This is an initial funding was 81, and ending value is 145. We've taken $5 million out.
Page 5.
Was that?
Yeah, so the initial funding was 81.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Okay, then I guess we're ready for PIMCO.
Do you all have any special time constraints that we should be aware of? Does that agenda look good?
Yeah, the agenda looks fine. Let's try to keep it around 20 minutes if we could, Matt, including questions.
Rick, no problem. Will do. We will keep it to 20 minutes, including questions. And maybe before we start, are there any things that are particularly top of mind for the board that you'd like to flag in the discussion just to make sure that we address them?
No, didn't appear to.
Okay, great. Well, why don't we jump right in then? We'll start with PIMCO update. If you all would turn with me to page 5, it's titled PIMCO Focus on Managing Risks and Delivering Returns. So you probably can recall a year ago that it was a much more interesting environment, much more dynamic environment for PIMCO. About this time last year, we were about 6 months into our leadership transition. Clearly, we had been in the press quite a bit in terms of some of the business pressures that, had exhibited on our organization. The good news is that has really stabilized substantially. We think really those headwinds are largely behind us. We've seen our assets under management stabilize at just under $1.5 trillion. So as of year-end, it was $1.43 trillion, as you can see on the top left-hand corner of the page. Maybe just to give you a little bit of additional context, if we were to go to December 31, 2014, our assets under management were $1.69 trillion. They dropped to $1.52 trillion at the end of June, and then at the end of September, they were $1.47, and then the end of December, $1.43. So the reason I share with you that additional detail is that you can tell the large majority of outflows from the firm happened in the first 6 months following our leadership transition. And since that point in time, we've seen a really steady, persistent decrease in terms of the AUM outflows, AUM reductions, to a point where we feel very satisfied with where we are in terms of our overall platform. You know as well, we've had the opportunity to visit with you many times, but so I won't go into all the detail on this page, but a couple of things worth highlighting. We remain a really well-resourced organization. I have just under 2,400 total employees, and of that, over 250 of those are portfolio managers. Interestingly enough, if you continue down the firm snapshot, while we're known as core and core plus fixed income managers, the very bottom of that column, you'll see that we have a diversified global business. Over 80% of our assets, in fact, are related to non-core strategies, and it's in many of those that we've seen really positive business developments, whether it's noteworthy inflows into our alternatives complex, or just investors coming to know us for different strategies, like multi-sector credit approaches or even income approaches. And those resources have really allowed us, over time, to help deliver on the objectives that we were working with you on. And we continue to add to those resources. So a big announcement for us at the end of last year was the formulation on the far right-hand side of our PIMCO Global Advisory Board. You can see the board members listed there. Many of these folks have been providing insights to PIMCO's investment process for quite a while before we formalized the board, but the formalization of the advice relationship we think is a really nice evolution in terms of the way we bring outside expertise into our investment process to benefit our clients' portfolios. And then finally, certainly at the risk of tooting our own horn a bit, we had some really good news at the beginning of this year in that PIMCO and Jerome Schneider and his broader team that focuses on cash management and short-term management strategies were named the Morningstar 2015 Mixed Income Manager of the Year Award. That's the third time we've won the award in the last 4 years, and we're very proud of Jerome's and his team's efforts, and we think that speaks to sort of the broad and deep resources that PIMCO brings to the table in terms of managing your investments. One last bit of information on this very, very busy page is at the very bottom you'll see in the middle, access to our latest investment views, blog.pimco.com. If you have a moment, that's worth checking out. It has really concise perspectives on the market environment, and their goal there is to provide information information that's understandable in quantities that are easy to read and digest. We've had everything in there from outlook for the Federal Reserve to what we expect for oil prices. We've got a lot of good reviews in terms of the content of that site. So if you have a moment, I do encourage you to visit and take a look at sort of all the things we're thinking about. Let me pause there. That was a lot of information on page 5 by way of a firm update. Any sort of questions you have before we move off of that that discussion?
Matt, did you have any personnel departures during 2015 that we should be aware of, analysts or PMs?
Well, we did have departures. At a high level, it was consistent with what we had experienced in past years. In regards to directly impacting Stan Sarah's portfolio, no. As you know, your lead portfolio is Tony Crescenzi, portfolio manager is Tony Crescenzi. He is our chief central bank watcher and continues to provide a lot of great insight in regards to that role. While we did have other portfolio managers leave the firm, I guess the only one that comes to mind as a generalist portfolio manager was a gentleman by the name of Saumil Parikh, whom I don't think you ever had the chance to meet. He simply decided to leave them to pursue their endeavors. But even as we've had people leave, we've had some pretty noteworthy additions on the PM side. A couple that come to mind are Joachim Fels, who's our chief global economic advisor, who was the chief economist at Morgan Stanley for many years. We also added a one by the name of Geraldine Sundstrom, who helps us with asset allocation decisions. So in terms of directly affecting the stance of our portfolio, no, and then more broadly, we have had departures and additions really consistent with what we've seen in the past in terms of adding resources and people moving on to different things in their careers. Sasha, if I've missed something, please feel free to chime in.
No, I think that sums it up. I would just add that, to echo Matt's point, nothing that we've seen over the last year has been unusual. We, in general, are a firm where every year we have some folks leave and some folks join, and we've seen more of that over the last year, but that's been within the normal course of business for us.
Why don't I, if there's no other questions, I'll just briefly touch, I won't drag you through all the information on page 6. We talked about the AUM dynamics already. And then if we can just turn very briefly to page 7. This is titled PEMCO's Investment Philosophy and Process, Leveraging Bottom-Up and Top-Down Expertise. This process really remains unchanged. So we evolve it at the margins. We try and improve it at the margins, but essentially what we try and do on your behalf is combine longer-term analysis of key trends affecting the global economy and markets. We then couple that with shorter-term outlook regarding the global economy to formulate broad overall views in terms of our expectations, and then we take those views and we integrate them with bottom-up, really robust security selection across different specialty desks. So what you'll see on the left-hand side is just sort of a snapshot of the groups that are involved. And then on the right-hand side, sort of all of the inputs that go into that portfolio construction process. And it's really by combining both the top-down, which we're very well known for, as well as, we think, really great resources in terms of bottom security selection, which I think we're not quite as well known for. Our goal is to produce stable, consistent portfolios that meet your longer-term return objectives. On page 8, we give you a little bit more information on the advisory board. Again, I don't think it's probably all that useful to go through each one of these individuals, but really just the rationale behind incorporating these folks into our investment process on a formal basis is that it's been clear to us for several years, and going forward, it's clear to us that policy decisions, both from monetary authorities as well as fiscal authorities, are going to have a disproportionate impact on market outcomes. And so what we've done is we've tried to identify individuals who can really provide
unique insights in terms of the way policymakers approach problems and the likely courses of actions they're going to pursue as we formulate our portfolio positioning. And so all the individuals there, in one form or another, have insights in that regard, and is the reason that we have formalized the relationship that we have with them over the last several months, and in some cases years. Why don't I pause there in terms of the market update? We're about 10 minutes into our 20 minutes of time, so I guess we need to be a little bit more concise in terms of going to the market review and discussing the portfolio outcomes and also economic outlook. Any questions before we shift to those topics?
No.
Great. Well, let me then give what I think will be a fairly concise market review, and then we'll shift to our newer portfolio in particular, and should time allow, a little bit of our recent forum and our economic outlook. So Matt said with utmost seriousness that Jerome Schneider on our short-term team won the Morningstar Fixed Income Manager of the Year Award. You know, and I had a client when I told him that, basically say, well, you know that it's a crazy market when the short-term manager wins the manager, Fixed Income Manager of the Year Award, and I think that's really true in the sense of this market. This market over the last year has been, broadly speaking, a sort of a risk-on, risk-off type environment, and really dominated much more by global development, technical factors, and flows, as opposed to the underlying bottoms-up view of the U.S. economy, which in our view is steadily improving. In the big picture, what you saw was interest rates rise just a little bit over the last year in most developed markets. That belies a lot of up and down in between. And you also saw credit spreads, the amount that you're paid to trade credit risk, rise as well, which means that credit prices did not hold up as well against this type of volatility that we've seen. We had a reversal of those trends over the beginning of this year, and especially the first 6 weeks of this year, where interest rates fell pretty dramatically across the developed world as people really became concerned about the outlook from China and what that would mean for bubble markets. Then, of course, we had another risk-on move in which, you know, people are now becoming a little bit more sanguine in terms of the global development and maybe thinking that it won't be so bad. So to summarize, a very volatile risk-on, risk-off type environment, and actually for a plan like yourself, a lot of opportunity then to generate some returns and potentially put some cash to work. What that means in terms of your portfolio, and I would direct you to page 16, your portfolio, the fixed income world portfolio we mentioned in the past, is truly doing what it's supposed to do in this type of environment, which is to say providing really a bulwark against the type of risk-off market sentiment that we saw in the beginning of this year and some of last year as well. We have a little bit updated numbers from what's on this page. Year-to-date, your portfolio is up 1.72%. Slightly under the performing the benchmark at 1.8%. But again, that's the type of increase that you would want to see in an environment in which your equities and other aspects of the portfolio are perhaps coming under some level of stress. Over the one-year horizon, the portfolio was up 0.9%, so outperforming benchmark by 32 basis points, and since the inception of the portfolio, 3.8% return, outperforming by 44 basis points. What we show on page 17 points to the consistency of performance, and here we look to the total return representative account, which is essentially the total return fund, so a little bit different in structure from your portfolio, but has a longer track record. That we thought would be relevant for this conversation. And here what we would point out is that we have outperformed the benchmark on a three-year period after fees roughly 95% of the time. And the key to doing that is to the sense of diversified sources of return. There are other managers who would put their eggs in a credit type basket, and that's the driver of returns in good markets and in bad markets. We tend to be a little bit more balanced in our approach and look for a bunch of little things to give us the combined sources of excess return that we're trying to achieve for your portfolio. So let me stop there and just see if there are any questions before I say a little bit more about the portfolio position and how we're structured.
I see none, Sasha.
Okay. So broadly speaking, and this is on the top of page 18, this is a conservatively positioned portfolio. The credit quality in your portfolio is AA minus, slightly below the benchmark at AA, but not really meaningfully, and is positioned for a moderately improving economic growth. And when I say moderately improving, we don't mean anything that's knocking the lights out, but in the United States, a 2-2.5% type growth environment, and a growth environment which the Fed then will be able to raise interest rates once or perhaps twice more this year. The way that you can see that in the portfolio positioning is when you look at that first line, which is effective duration, that's essentially the interest rate risk that we're taking in your portfolio. What you can see is that we're taking a little bit less interest rate risk than the benchmark is taking, and the primary reason for that is our view that the Fed is likely to continue to raise rates, and we want to be a little bit more defensive with your capital in that environment. The other position that's notable that I would mention is that we do have some holdings of Treasury inflation-protected securities. Those tend to do well and be really a hedge in your portfolio against periods in which inflation might surprise higher than the market expects. Precisely the opposite has happened over the last year or two, in the sense that those positions then have been a detractor to performance. But when we look at the market today, the inflation expectations implied in the market are roughly 1.5% over 10 years. So what that means is that the Fed not only would have to miss its 2% inflation target next year or the year after, but every year over 10 years in order for that to be realized. So it's essentially saying the market lacks confidence that the Fed is going to do its job, which we just simply don't believe. The Fed has a lot of tools at its disposal to improve economic growth and therefore the inflation outlook, especially as unemployment continues to tick lower, which has traditionally been a period in which we see higher inflation. The other thing that I would flag is that we continue to be modestly bullish on housing, and the way that we are expressing that in your portfolio is via positions in non-agency mortgages. They're mortgages that are not backed by the federal government and are therefore more linked to changes in housing prices. Although we've been underweight in terms of our holdings of credit, we have been adding credit opportunistically over the last few weeks, especially as we've seen the market sell off in the beginning of this year and there began to be dislocations that made particular credits look attractive. Financials have been a key area of focus, notably HSBC, Bank of America, General Motors Finance, and some of these blue chip names that, frankly, investors got a little bit over their skis, we believe, in terms of being worried about things like negative interest rates and beat up financials to the point where we felt that there was a pretty compelling buy opportunity there. So we've been out adding to your portfolio in that respect. Let me stop there. I'm aware that we're quite close on time. I'm happy to talk about our economic outlook, or we're happy to end there as well.
What is your prediction of interest rate increases this year, 2016?
Yeah. So given our outlook of modestly improving economic growth, we do believe that the Fed is likely to raise interest rates roughly twice more this year. So perhaps one in June, perhaps not, but really leaving the option open and maybe one more beyond that. The market is pricing in. Now the market's pricing in roughly 1.5-ish, so a little bit below that. But if you looked back at the market in February timeframe, you would have seen the market saying that the Fed was basically not going to raise interest rates, not only this year, but into next year as well, which we thought was just wildly too pessimistic for the economic data that's coming out, which again was fairly decent, all things equal.
All right, I think that's it.
Great. So again, Matt and I, just on behalf of all of us at PIMCO, want to thank you. We know it's been frankly a long 2 years to have been a PIMCO client. We very much appreciate the time and the effort and the energy that you have spent with us, thinking about the firm and thinking about your investment with the firm, and just are very appreciative of you and of the relationship with you, and hope to continue it for a long time.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Have a great day.
Any questions on this little thing here? Again, this, I know we're doing a good job because it really bears out closely to what we're seeing on their reports as well. We talk about subtracting fees, and over the last years, they have essentially given us the benchmark returns for the fees that we're paying. We did have a very extremely difficult year in 2014, and I don't even know if you can call 15 a rebounding year, but at least we're right at the benchmark.
Yeah. Now, so just a quick update on Verisk's perspective on PIMCO. We have the organization on watch as overall as the firm, given the instability, given the departures of L. Arian and Mr. Gross in 2014. We issued a formal terminate memo on the PIMCO total return strategy, which is what you have here, and that was done prior to the board hiring Verisk as your consultant. So that was back in earlier 2015. We are in the process of revisiting that, and so we have our manager research team, a representative from there, and one of our consultants going down to Newport Beach next week, so I'll be happy to provide you with the updates that come out of that. Basically, my impression is that you've weathered the storm. You've gone through the part of Mr. Gross's departure and then getting new people in place to manage this, and they've done that reasonably well. Their assets that they talked about, 1.69, currently 1.43 trillion, most of that was in the Bill Gross managed funds. The total return fund, if I remember correctly, was once a $400 billion strategy. Today it's about a $100 billion strategy. So three-fourths of it has left. So it was that kind of size and disruption. And when you see that kind of outflow, then it obviously gives you, pause. Is this going to really be an issue of we're the last ones holding the bag kind of thing? And it did. They seem to have stopped it before it got to that situation. So still a large diversified portfolio, and they seem to be getting their shop in order, but I'll provide you with the update once we know more.
So I this new advisory board thing, I mean, these are heavy hitter names. Is that just a window dressing thing? Did they run out and throw a bunch of money at people and say, can we put our name on your portfolio?
They've had a long history of doing that. So before this group, Greenspan was on it. So they've been doing this for a while, and yes, they have them come into their annual secular forum, and I don't know how extensive they use them, but it's not like they have Ben Bernanke as their economist today.
Yeah, he's just such a pretty face.
So, yeah. So Ed, I have a question. By these high-level investment managers leaving the firm, you said back in 2014? What... Did the size change, or did something fundamental change with this company, with this investment firm?
Fundamentally, it changed because Bill Gross was the founder and CEO. L. Arian was hired as co-CEO and CIO. So these are the highest levels of their firm. Mm-hmm. L. Arian's departure was abrupt, not well planned, not well broadcast, so that's an indication to us that something's wrong. People don't just do that in the investment management world, and companies don't just let that happen. They work through that as best they can. So because that happened, that was a signal. That was at the beginning of 2014, and there were other departures throughout the year, ultimately resulting in Mr. Gross's departure, which was another big surprise. Whoa, the founder and CEO left. What's that all about? So that changed it from a real star system, him leading it, to more committee-based, And then it took time to get to know, who's this committee? How are they going to work together? Bill Gross was kind of a portfolio manager that did what he wanted to do. He had free reign. And so it was a big question about how did he make investment decisions and how are they going to replace that? And is this going to be the Pinto total return of old? Probably not. So the results that they've been able to stay in line with the index are actually really good news, that it hasn't fallen
stabilizing,
apart.
You think?
Stabilizing. I'm not sure if it's, you know, the top recommendation going forward or not, but as we go through the asset allocation and other things, we'll have a chance to revisit those decisions and think through it again.
Thank you.
All right. So next up is Shane.
Yes. So I'm sorry to say I don't have the February flash report. We get the information from the custodian on the 11th business day of the month, which was yesterday. Sometimes we're lucky to cut it close enough and I can bring the handout with me, and we weren't able to do that this time. Interestingly, though, I found out that that 11th business day is something we might be able to change with the custodian. It's something that is agreed upon between Stan Sarah and Northern Trust.
Oh.
So we'll look into seeing if we can bump that up a couple days and maybe be more consistent with bringing that to you. So in lieu of providing you with the February flash report this month, I'll bring both February and March to the next meeting. So we'll work through that. Certainly February, and I hope March. The next is the private equity educational session. So we have two representatives from Pathway with us today. And so I think you have the materials. I will just politely slide to the side. But this is in response to the asset allocations we looked at and those having private equity allocations and the board saying we need to learn more before we can prove that. So maybe we can do an education session. So I put Pathway on a tight leash, no marketing, no bragging about your funds or fees or anything else, strictly education. And we'll go from there. So this is Linda and Jason.
Do you want to stay there?
I'm just going to stay inside here. You can take those two spots.
Afternoon. It looks like, does everybody have the materials? Great, thank you. Well, thanks for the opportunity to talk to private equity today. It's an asset class that we're very passionate about. And just some very quick introductions so you know who we are. My name is Linda Chafin. I've been with Pathway for a little over 5 years. I focus on our clients and client servicing. And I've been in private equity, M&A banking for many more years than I'd like to admit to, so we'll just leave it at that. This is Jason Jenkins. He's a director with Pathway. He's been a private equity investor for over 12 years. He's an owner of our firms. We are a partnership, and we're owned by our 18 partners. Jason's expertise really is in evaluating funds, diligencing them, building portfolios, and he does quite a bit of work with public pension plans as well. So when we talked to Ed, and he said, talk to us about private equity, one of the surprising things that we hear when we talk to people is that private equity as an asset class really has been around since the 1930s, and it's gone under different names. So it wasn't known as private equity back then. You may recognize terms like leveraged buyouts or HLTs, highly leveraged transactions, merchant banking. So it's been around for a very long time. Public pension plans really started investing in private equity after 1978. There were some guidelines and rules and regs that got ironed out, and that's really when public plans started investing. It really became prominent in the early 1980s. And so when we said we've got about 30 minutes to talk about private equity, what should we cover at a high level? We're going to have Jason kind of kick things off and talk about what is private equity, who invests in it, why. We'll talk about some of the risks, some of the rewards, and then we'll finish up with talking about some of the different ways that you can approach the asset class. So if you have questions as we go along, please feel free to ask them.
Thank you. And thank you for having us. So I thought we would start out by first defining what private equity is. And I think the easiest way to do that is to contrast it to public equity. So if you look at slide 4, we've got two boxes here. On the left-hand side, you have public equity. Very liquid asset class, low transaction costs, widely dispersed ownership, information is readily available. Everyone is using the same information theoretically to make investment decisions, and it's a relatively passive strategy. All of that boils down to a relatively efficient market. And when you have an efficient market, the opportunity to generate outsized returns is lower. Now contrast that to private equity. These investments tend to be illiquid. In order to invest in private equity, you need a long-term time horizon. Ownership is typically concentrated. That makes it easier to affect change amongst the companies. Information is not readily available, and ownership is not widely dispersed. And this is an active strategy. Managers get heavily involved in setting strategy affecting change within companies. So all these aspects point to an inefficient market, a market in which the opportunity to generate outsized returns exists. And that's one of the key aspects in investing in private equity, the ability to generate returns that outperform the public markets. But that doesn't come without risks. And I plan in this presentation to spend some time discussing those risks inherent with the asset class. So there are really two commonly cited reasons for investing in private equity. The first one is on slide five. And it's being able to expand the opportunity set. So there are over 100,000 companies in the United States that generate annual revenue in excess of $10 million. 95% of those companies are privately held. In order to capture that opportunity set, you need to invest in private equity. Another reason to invest in private equity on slide six, and this is the most widely cited reason to invest in private equity, is the opportunity to generate strong, long-term relative returns. Private equity has a history of doing this. We've shown composite returns for private equity. It's the dark blue and green bars over 10 years, 15 years, and 20-year time periods. And we've compared the performance here to the broader public market indices, and you can see that the outperformance across each one of these time horizons is over 300 basis points. That outperformance has continued through today. So if you look at the last 1 year of performance in private equity, and this performance is through 9/30 of last year, private equity has generated close to a 9% return, where the public markets have been relatively flat. So the outperformance has continued. That strong performance has been accompanied by strong distributions back to investors. You can see that on slide seven. U.S. private equity funds distributed $475 billion in 2014, and we're still calculating the data for 2015, but we're on track to have even more distributions this year. And this highlights an interesting aspect of investing in private equity. Private equity is a self-liquidating asset. Managers make investments, they generate value, and they return that value back to investors in the form of a realization. And so if you invest in private equity consistently over a long period of time, you'll have a situation in which the amount you're getting back potentially can substantially exceed the amount you're investing in. And so it creates a nice positive cash flow that can come back into the portfolio. So we've talked about the rewards of private equity. I think it's very important to consider the risks. I think these are critical. Private equity has a greater degree of risk than public equity. Some of the commonly cited risks we've shown on the left-hand side of this balance. We've already talked about information inefficiencies. It's a rather illiquid asset class with long holding periods. And there is a higher degree of company-specific risk. But that company-specific risk can be diversified away. A typical private equity portfolio has hundreds of investments, hundreds of companies in the portfolio. So any loss associated with one single company will not have a material impact on the overall portfolio. Now that being said, while those risks are important, we believe that an often overlooked risk and a critical risk is poor manager selection. So our research shows that this factor, poor manager selection, has a bigger impact on the ultimate performance of a private equity portfolio than the risk we show on the left-hand side of this. And we've shown this various pieces of data supporting this on slide nine. The quality of the investment manager responsible for investing in private equity is critical. And you can see the impact on the left-hand side. What we did here is gather up information on the universe of private equity funds, several thousand. And we looked at the performance spread between upper quartile managers and lower quartile managers. And you can see in the green bar that that spread is quite wide. It's about 17 percentage points. And that highlights that there's a large penalty for getting manager selection wrong. Now contrast that to the public equity markets. The difference between upper quartile and lower quartile performance is much smaller. Now you can see the impact that that has on fund performance in the right-hand side here. If you focus your attention in the middle bar here, U.S. all private equity, the composite return over the last 12 years is 14.1%. But if you fail to invest in upper quartile funds, that drops all the way down to 6.6%, which is roughly in line with public equities, and it doesn't compensate you for the risk you're taking with private equity.
Hey, Jason, if investors are constantly vying for that upper quartile, which obviously must be happening, what's happening to the lower quartile? Are they being recycled into and out of this space, or what is their disposition?
Yeah, that's a good point. The access in this asset class is very important. So there is much more demand for those top quartile managers than the actual size of the funds themselves. And if you don't have access to those upper quartile funds, your return perspective in private equity will be much different. When you have a fund that generates consistent poor performance and ranks in the lower quartile, oftentimes those funds will wind down and disband. So we've seen this particularly in the late 90s. There was a proliferation of venture capital funds that were raised, several hundred. And though many of those funds weren't able to raise subsequent funds. And so the ultimate number of managers in venture capital scaled down over time. And so that speaks to your point.
Well, I mean, but what do we know of all the funds? I mean, all the businesses, do we have information on how they're all doing?
We do, because they continue to track the fund's performance continues to get tracked until the very end of the partnership's life. So it includes all of the funds, the performance, both the good funds and the bad funds.
From our perspective, we also see where a private equity fund that does well and has a nice successful fund or two and goes out to raise its next fund, there will be indicators about that fund. If they're suddenly trying to double in size or something like that, we were successful with $500 million, we now want to raise $1 billion, that's going to raise a question. Wait a minute. What makes you think you can put $1 billion to work and generate the same returns? You better have a really good story, right? So that's going to.
But how is that different than the other managed funds we have? The public
ones? Well, exactly. That's the exact same kind of analysis. Okay. That when we're looking at it, we're saying we got to put the same scrutiny to these. Now, I'm speaking for what Pathway does. So, but it's kind of the same approach. And when we look at the private equity space, these are the same.
So what is the information inefficiency? We're like, what don't we know about the private fund that we do know about the public fund?
Well, it's what the manager is looking at when they make the investment.
So it's a higher trust factor on our part.
It does entail a higher trust factor when you're investing in private equity. But the fact that when a manager is making an investment decision, they may be entitled to have different information than everyone else looking at that opportunity creates an opportunity to generate outsized returns. Contrast that to the public market where, for example, if I'm making an investment decision on General Electric, I have basically the same information as everyone else does.
So that your managers are able to go in and scrutinize the financials of these prospective companies.
Absolutely, yes.
Do we know who the other investors are in the fund?
You do.
You
do.
So we know who our partners are.
You do, yes.
You had mentioned that in order to get the reduced risk, you have to have like 100 plus companies.
Yes.
Give me a sense, dollars. What are we talking about, a company or 100 companies?
Yes. So, and this speaks to portfolio construction. So when we put together a portfolio, we'll typically put 20 individual funds into that portfolio. And that fund will make between 10 to 30 investments.
Wait, wait, I'm still stuck. Each fund having 100 companies?
Each fund will have between 10 to 30 companies, and we'll put together a portfolio of, let's say, 20 individual fund managers. We actually have a slide here. The next slide coming up will demonstrate this, because it is a bit unique the way you do this. So the structural aspects of private equity are unique. You make investments in private equity through a limited partnership structure. And this structure has been developed for strong alignment of interest between the investors and the manager. So on the right-hand side, you have the manager. This is the green box. They're referred to as the general partner. And they serve as the investment manager. They're making investment decisions. They bear the liability, and they contribute a significant portion of their own personal capital. While this isn't a large amount of the overall fund size, it tends to be a significant amount of their own net worth. And in return for that, in return for generating strong performance, they receive a share of the upside or the potential profits. Those potential profits are only entitled to the general partner after they return back management fees and they reach some sort of return threshold, which is typically 8%. Now, the left-hand side of this shows the limited partners, and that's the investors. And typically, there's anywhere between 10 to 100 limited partners per fund, and they have an oversight role. But they're not actively involved in making investment decisions. And this is where you would fall. They provide the majority of the capital and limited liability. The general partner will then make investments, a diversified set of investments, typically between 10 to 30. Those investments would be spread out over time. So to further those points, if you look at slide 11 here, this partnership, and this is a key difference between public equity and private equity. This is when you invest in a private equity partnership, it has a finite life, typically 10 years. You make an initial commitment to the asset class, let's say $10 million, but the money is not invested all on day one. The general partner then will spend several years finding investments, and as they find investments, the capital will be drawn down. That's referred to as the investment period. Those investments generally are held for maybe 3 to 5 years. Value is created. That's called the development phase of a partnership's life. And then they're harvested. As a result of this structure, performance in the first couple years of a partnership's life isn't meaningful. And you can see an example of that in the figure below. So the money is, and focus on the green line here, the money gets drawn down over the first few years. And then over time, value is created, and then they begin selling companies. And then you become cash flow positive. And the greater the distributions, the greater the proceeds from the sales, the higher your return ultimately is.
So none of what Jason just said is pretty much, it's very similar to what we already do and see with our direct lenders. One of the differences, though, on that curve that Jason was pointing out on page 11, it takes several years longer before you start to see any money back in the investment than we do with the direct lenders.
It's also similar to the real estate.
Very much so.
This is,
these structures are very similar to what we've been doing.
Can I just ask a question on slide 10 there?
Yes.
So where is Bernie Madoff here? Is he the green box?
No. So private equity has a long history of generating returns successfully for pensions and avoiding situations like Madoff. This is, you know, what Madoff was obviously a hedge fund. This is private equity. Not to speak too much about what we do, we look at 500 of these opportunities a year, and we do extensive. We got 42 investment professionals that are doing extensive due diligence on each one of these funds. We're doing background checks on the managers. We're verifying the performance. Tremendous amount of due diligence.
Again, can you give me an idea of size on anything?
Yeah.
Companies range in size from $1 million to $10 million. Companies range from $5 to $5,000.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Let me on the next slide, I can give you a sense of that.
It's all gobbledygook until you get down to numbers.
So
Gordon, just go ahead and read ahead.
The simple answer is private equity is targeting all shapes and sizes of assets. So we're targeting companies that have $10 million of revenue, investments of $10 million in size, all the way up to several billion in size. Some of the very large buyouts have been, recent buyouts have been $10 billion or greater. So we're targeting all the stages of a company's life. So if you look on the left-hand side of this, early in a company's development, before it's gone public, companies need growth. Need capital finance growth. So if you think about Facebook or Alibaba or Google, you know, venture capital, which is a private equity strategy, was providing that necessary capital to generate value. And those companies grew to a substantial size before they ultimately went public, several billion dollars. And between that period of when the business plan was created and when they went public, the funding for that came from venture capital. And that would be a strategy in private equity. Now, as a company continues to develop and grow, its earnings stabilize, its revenue stabilize, and then you start being targeted by what are commonly referred to as buyout funds. And buyout funds are looking for stability because oftentimes they'll use or fund the purchase with a portion of debt. Private equity doesn't necessarily stop there, though. We'll follow the company through the entire life cycle. So whether it be through competitive pressures or through market factors, a company will may eventually experience some sort of distress. And so we have managers that employ turnaround strategies associated with pursuing opportunities. Take, for example, the last financial crisis. So we provided rescue capital for the auto industry, the finance industry, the travel industry. All of these were hit very hard. And that led to significant gains in 2010 and 11 for the turnaround managers.
Gordon, have we?
Not even.
Let me pause for a second. I'll throw out some numbers. It's a tough question to answer, and here's why. If you look at a buyout fund, typically what you would see is they'll have 10 to 20 portfolio companies. If you look at a venture capital fund, maybe 20 to 40 portfolio companies. So when you're putting your portfolio together, Stan Sarah were to look at this and put it together, the question you would have to ask yourselves, the folks sitting around this table, and with the help of Varis, is how many investments do I want to make? Do I want to make one investment? Do I want to make 10 investments? Do I want to focus on, as Jason said, do I want to focus on venture capital where the companies are smaller, there's more growth opportunity, but there's more risk? Do I want to focus more on the buyouts category? Recognizing that there are different return drivers with each one of these stages of the life cycle. So it's not an easy question to answer.
Is there a correlation between average size and strategy that the investor chooses to employ? Like if it's a mm-hmm. mezzanine venture capital buyout, LBO, or does that have anything to do with the average size?
Average size of the company
the companies that are comprised of the portfolio.
Yeah. So typically, private equity overall will pursue companies that are smaller than what you would normally see in the public markets. So we're looking at small cap companies, even companies that would be smaller than the typical small cap companies.
When you buy, as you say, you buy the whole company, not half a company.
It depends on the strategies that's being
anything's
being,
open okay.
being utilized. So if it's
typically control.
Yeah. Typically control.
But there are strategies that are non-control strategies.
Yes.
But I'll contrast that.
The important thing is that the managers are actively involved in the companies, making investment decisions, affecting change within the companies. That's the key, I think the key aspect there.
Do they tend to focus on sectors so that a manager may focus more on one type of company that
yes.
they have perhaps more expertise in to be able to help guide that company?
Very much so. So on slide 13, the third strategy down, we refer to it as special situations. And this is actually a strategy that's been gaining more prominence. And what this is either managers that utilize a hybrid strategy or they have an industry focus. So, for example, there are a number of managers that will pursue just opportunities in the consumer space or the software space. That's one of the things that the advisor will, the role that they play is evaluating the expertise of those managers within the strategies.
So, for instance, when we were first exposed to our credit concept, they said there was an opportunity because of the structure within banking, certain people couldn't get loans. What you're saying is there's an opportunity in anything, any size, any amount, whether you buy all or part, and you'd be part of the group that bought out GM.
Right.
Okay.
And that is the responsibility of Pathway along with the underlying managers that we're selecting. So when we're doing our due diligence, it focuses on the expertise of the manager itself and their ability to identify where value is and direct their investments.
So there has to be some way for us as a group to take the world and focus on something.
Yes, yes.
So then what is our liability? You say it's a limited liability. What if a company or file that you finance file bankruptcy? So you as a manager has some responsibility or some liability for that, or?
It stops with the partnership itself. It does not flow through to Pathway or to our investors, yes.
You can only lose the capital that you invest.
Yes.
So in other words, they can't come back to you and say, hey, our company's not doing well. We'd like you to, we'd like to get into some of your other pockets. There's no ability for them to pierce that veil.
But if I heard you earlier, you said that you construct your portfolio in such a way that you would have 20 companies. If one of them went bankrupt, you still had 19 other companies that are going to generate some revenue.
Yes.
You just wouldn't get, instead of getting, you know, a 10% return, you would only get a 9.5% return because one of them dropped out or something like that.
Absolutely.
Your concept of
limited
partnerships in which you have different groups and you've got investment in 10 to 20 companies in several different groups who in turn pile together, is that the same structure as fund to funds, where you have a fund here, fund here, fund here, and you put it together and you're top of managing the fund to funds?
Absolutely. So Pathway would serve as the manager of the fund to fund vehicle. And I believe we have a slide later in the presentation that kind of shows how that structure is.
Gotcha. Page 10 overlays that. But you know, one thing to point out when we talk about size, I won't get the numbers exactly correct, but if you look at the average market cap of a company in the S&P 500, it's almost $2 billion. So when you think about where is private equity investing, it's a lot smaller than that. I mean, there are occasions where there are $2 billion deals, but it's really much smaller opportunities than that. And
that's why I have trouble seeing names like this that look kind of big.
Yes.
We want you to recognize them.
So there really is, if you turn to slide 14, three basic ways to generate value in private equity. So there's operations improvement. So this is the idea of I'm going to increase the revenue and increase the earnings. The second is multiple arbitrage. And what that basically means is de-risking the investment so that you can have someone else pay a higher multiple for that company. And then the final aspect is leverage. So using or financing a portion of the purchase price with debt, and then over time paying that debt down. Now, the makeup of value creation in private equity has evolved over time and changed. So if you go back to the 80s, when our company's founders were doing some of the original buyout investing, you take a company like some investments like KKR, where they're investing in Safeway. Very large portion of those transactions were funded with debt. And that's where a good portion of the value creation has come from. But that has actually evolved over time. And now the primary driver of value creation within private equity isn't leverage, isn't multiple expansion, but it's operational improvements. So it's the managers having deep operating teams, getting involved, making acquisitions, improving sales, expanding into new markets. That's the primary thing that is generating the attractive returns of private equity today. So in terms of who invests in private equity, we've provided some stats on slide 15. right here we show the top 1,000 public defined benefit plans in the U.S. And as you can see here, the allocation to private equity, while it varies amongst the different public pension plans, it typically ranges between 5 to 15%. The stat we have here is 9%. So it is a substantial but relatively small portion of the overall portfolio. In terms of the aggregate capital that's currently invested in private equity, public pensions represent a substantial portion of that, 30%. That equates to several hundred billions of capital being invested in the asset class.
What is other 8%? What is the other?
It includes not family offices. It includes financial institutions.
We have that down here at 14%.
Banks and financial institutions. What is in the other bucket? I'll have to get back to you on that. It's I should know that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Would it be private people? Can private people?
Yeah.
Could I invest
sure.
in it?
Can be high net.
Yeah,
no,
I couldn't,
but
it.
Jim could.
There's some superannuation funds in there. Some superannuation funds for
corporate.
I think that falls into the private sector. That bucket there.
So, not to add another layer of complexity to this, but there are three core ways in which you can invest in private equity. I talked about the first part of this, investing through what's referred to as a primary fund investment. That's the structure that we've discussed today. The key here, and the key aspect of investing in primaries, is that you get time diversification. So the manager is investing over multiple years. You're not overly exposed to any one point in the economic cycle, and that's a key aspect here. There's another alternative way to invest in private equity, and that's through the purchase of an interest that's currently owned by another limited partner. And that's referred to as a secondary investment. And
sounds incestuous.
So there's a market for buying and selling of LP interest. So for various reasons, an LP may want to sell their stake, and you can buy that stake. Typically, you can buy that stake at a discount. And what that does is give you immediate access to the asset class, oftentimes at an attractive price. And it also will shorten the time until you become cash flow positive, which you referred to earlier. The key here, though, is that you do have less time diversification because you are purchasing the portfolio at one single point in time, not across a multiple cycle. And then finally, there's another very interesting way in which you can gain access to the asset class, and that as a limited partner, investing directly in the company alongside the partnership. And that's referred to in the industry as a direct co-investment. And this has some very attractive aspects in that it helps you gain additional exposure to the asset class at no fee and no carry. So it's very economically favorable way in which you can gain exposure.
So switching gears, so now you've heard a little bit about the asset class. We try to delve in at a high level in terms of ways to actually implement a private equity program. So if you turn to page 18.
I want to ask a question for you. How do these things come to an end? In other words, let's say we're invested for 10 years or 8 or 10 years. What's the end to it? How does it come?
Yeah. So beginning around year 8, the portfolio goes into a wind down phase in which the general partner is actively selling their companies. The goal is to completely liquidate the entire portfolio by year 10. In event they're not able to do that, the fund has a provision in place in which the term of the fund can be extended a few years to do that. From our perspective, we don't want the general partner to have to hastily sell a company. We want them to sell the company at the right time. And so that's what the purpose of that extension period allows for.
Do you ever consult with the limited partners on whether they want to continue, if this thing's really doing well? Is that ever come into play? Or do you ever take these companies public, which makes it a very easily liquidating event?
So the manager has various ways in which they can realize the investment. So they can seek a strategic buyer, they can sell to another private equity firm, or they can take the company public. And they're exploring all three of those options at all times.
Any other questions before we dig into a little bit on the implementation side?
Just one more question for me. As an investor, how much control do we have over the choices of companies that are purchased?
There is a degree of control, but the partnership is structured in a manner in which there is a bit of freedom for the manager to identify the types of companies they want to pursue their own. That's really what we're hiring the manager to do.
So you can include or exclude sectors?
Sure. There is provisions in place. For example, if there are industries that are particularly sensitive, for example, alcohol, firearms, energy investments, there typically are provisions in place in the LPA that enables an individual LP to be excluded from those investments.
Thank you. To Jason's point, up front, you want to have those conversations with the general partner or with the fund manager before you make the investment, because once the documentation is signed, then you're really partnered with them, and they're going to go out and execute the strategy.
Is that what you call a side letter?
Yeah, absolutely.
And is the manager solely in charge of the decision to sell it or get out of it or who to sell it to and all that kind of stuff? Mm-hmm.
So they are, but every partnership has an advisory board and the advisory board is typically comprised of major investors. Pathways typically on the advisory board, and we meet regularly with the general partner to go over their strategy. Each partnership has a limited partnership agreement, which dictates how they invest the fund. And so if there's any situation where they want to invest in perhaps a different strategy, they would have to get approval by either the limited partners or the advisory board members.
That being said, you don't want to cross from limited to general partners, so you don't want to start taking on that role.
But I mean, it's not worth, once you invest, we're done in terms of policy. The manager does all that.
Yes.
Even if we don't want them to do something.
So there's a key thing that we negotiate. There's a key aspect that we negotiate on your behalf for every partnership, and it's called a no-fault divorce. And that means you can get out of the partnership at any time you want to. And that's a deal-breaker for us. We have to have it when we make a commitment.
On the other hand,
you might suffer financially, but you can get out.
That's it. Sorry.
Yes, that when we were talking about secondary investments and that can be at a very attractive price, that's because the people who are leaving often do not realize a lot of return on because of the illiquid nature of the investment.
Absolutely. The discounts, particularly in this environment, are maybe 5% though. In some situations, there's a lot of money that has flowed into the secondaries market right now. In many situations, we've seen the opportunity to sell partnerships at above their net asset value.
Hmm. And there are different reasons, different reasons that people would want to sell. For example, maybe a plan decides, I'm not going to invest in venture capital in the future, so I'm going to go ahead and exit. I'm going to sell this in the secondary market. Doesn't mean it's not a good performer. It doesn't mean it's not a great manager. It just means I'm not going to invest in venture anymore, so I'm going to cleanse that out of my portfolio. So we see a lot of tilting kind of portfolio management. It's not necessarily a negative stigma that you might think, where this is a piece of crap and I'm just going to flush it out at whatever price I can. Certainly that happens, but the large majority is kind of portfolio pruning, saying I'm just not going to invest in this anymore. I don't want to spend the time on it. I don't have the resources, and so I'm going to exit that way.
We saw
it's a lot to think about.
Secondary market probably 3 years ago. There was a lot of fundraising going on. The opportunities were really attractive. There was that market. Today, we're not seeing the secondaries as much. So, you know, to Jason's point on slide 16, when Sansara is interested in making that allocation, we can be somewhat directive in terms of saying we want more venture capital type exposure, or we want more buyout middle market exposure, or we want more secondaries, or we don't want any co-invests or something like that. We can be that specific about it, in addition to the guidelines that Jason mentioned.
Thank you. I'm recognizing that we're probably a little tight on time. Shall we go ahead or?
Yeah, a few more minutes.
Okay,
please.
Great. So page 18, we thought we'd give you a snapshot into the various stages of investing in private equity. And, you know, kind of the first pillar is the planning. This is where you talk about look at your assets, look at your liabilities, look at your cash flow. How much can I invest in private equity? That's sort of the first decision that you make. And that kind of guides the next three steps, if you will. Most people think about private equity as investing, that orange bucket where you build your portfolio. How many funds am I going to invest in? What strategies? There's still a lot of planning involved in this bucket because most private equity firms raise capital just every 3 or 4 years. So you got to consider that in terms of the timing of when you're putting your portfolio together. And typically this is, you know, this is the identifying, the sourcing, the analyzing, the accessing, doing the legal docs. That's that orange bucket. The next phase, your work is not done. This brown bucket is what we call monitoring. And it's important to be engaged in your portfolio, similar to what you have with your credit investments. You want to understand the deals. You want to understand the valuation. You want to understand what's happening with your managers. You want to build those relationships because if things are going well, you'd like to invest in their next fund. So it takes time to develop those relationships. You also want to understand valuation. And every public pension plan today wants to understand fees. So you've got to spend time getting to know your general partners and understanding what's going on in your portfolio. And then the last piece, because of the nature of private equity, as Jason described, every fund, every private equity manager will call capital on an as-needed basis. So you might get 5 or 10 days notice to say, hey, we're going to make this investment, we're going to send you a notice, and we're quote, calling capital. So everyone does that individually, and then also you'll get capital returned. And as you mentioned, Rick, about stock, you can get a stock distribution, but then you need a policy in place of how am I going to execute that? Do I sell it all on day one? Do I sell it over time? You know, how do I work with those distributions? Every public pension plan probably has to have their portfolio audited, and of course no one gets away from taxes. You will get a K-1 form from every single public or private equity firm that you invest with. So lots of work on the backside.
One question has been asked, you gotta ask this. Are fees generally paid on uncommitted capital?
Fees typically are paid on committed capital. So if upfront you make a $10 million investment, typically you'll be paying a fee on the $10 million, even though, let's say, over time you get calls down.
So even if you go through the first couple of years and you've only had half a call, you're paying the whole.
So the structure of fees tends to be front end loaded. For the first few years, you're paying, you know, what would be considered a full fee.
So you're front loaded on fees, and your return is back loaded.
So
right.
So you get double whammied in the front, but later on you get the money.
And the reason for that structure. Is because the general partner is doing the most work up front, identifying companies, making the investments, and creating the value. But that period, that investment period, is very short, and then the fee scales down quite a bit after that. So if another fund is raised, the fee will then scale down, or if the fund's investment period expires, the fund will fee down.
Is it a percentage, like up front it's blank percent, and later on it's less?
Yes. Yes.
Can you give me a rough idea?
So typical management fee in private equity is 1.5% of commitments initially, and then it scales down to 1 to 1.5% of cost, or current cost, or the amount that's invested in there.
Not much of a scale down.
And then, in addition to that, there tends to be a number of ways in which the management fee actually is reduced beyond that. For example, in repayment for being on the board of a company, the general partner will receive a fee. That fee then goes to reduce the LP's management fees. And those fees, and they're referred to as offsets, those offsets can be very substantial. So in many cases, for the partnerships that we're investing in, that even though the headline fee may be 1.5%, we're actually not paying any management fee at all.
And that's something that our administration would be tracking and following.
Yeah, and one other key point here, and it speaks to this alignment of interest. The general partner not only is putting a large portion of their net worth in this alongside the limited partners, they're sharing in the profits. But those profits are not taken until all of the management fees that the LPs have paid have been given back or returned. So before they can start to generating, taking profits, they have to, LPs have to receive back all of the management fees that have been paid.
It's the same thing that we're doing now.
A lot of good counting.
I mean, it's hard to keep track of everything, but at least what he's saying is very familiar to me.
At least, and he's talking about having a fund, which in turn has funds, and the funds would have 10 to 30 who then go to the big fund, and as you say, you'll have over 100 funds to track.
100 companies.
100 companies. 100 companies to track. Okay.
Simple.
I can see a request for staff.
Well, this is a great segue. Practically speaking, there are two ways to invest in private equity. You can build a direct program, or you can execute, hire a fund-to-fund manager. And page 19 here, we thought we'd just put down a few comments. We've talked about building your portfolio, how many funds, what strategies, what types of investments, and we've talked about the benefits of diversification and portfolio construction. Consider vintage year exposure. You don't want to have all of your capital in one year, so you want to put it in over time, so you're managing that. The biggest pro of doing it directly is you have a lot of flexibility. You can take your foot on and off the gas pedal or the brake. You can build the portfolio exactly the way you want it. The biggest con of building your portfolio directly is it's a lot of work. And there are definitely requirements for time, resources, staff, and it increases over time. So as you're investing in private credit funds, imagine that you do 5 to 6 funds per year. Sounds pretty simple. 5 years in, you're now in 25 to 30 funds. If you just go to annual meetings, you're now doing 30 annual meetings, and you are literally doing hundreds of capital calls every year. So, the burden increases over time as and we're just talking about a simple portfolio of 5 to 6 funds per year. It's not a lot. And thus the fund-to-fund model was born. It's sort of an elegant way to deal with the challenges of the direct model. It kind of takes care of the stages 2, 3, and 4 on the prior page. And one of the other benefits that comes to using a fund-to-fund manager is not just that they're putting the portfolio together, monitoring, they're administering it, is that they have relationships with the general partner. So depending on the size of the investor you are, there's a benefit to size. The bigger investor you are, the more important you are to the general partner, the better access you have to those high quality funds. And Jason showed you how important that is. And so the appeal really is it relieves the burden. The biggest con is there's a fee that's associated with you. You've probably heard of the extra layer of fees. Well, I guess the question that you have to consider is for the staff, the resources, the time, is this a cost-effective way of entering the market? And page 20 gives you that pictorial that we talked about of the fund-to-funds model. So you see at the top the blue box, the investor, the limited partner. In your case, that would be Stan Sara. On the right side, you have the manager. That's the general partner of the fund-to-fund. They pool the money together. That's why they call it a pooled vehicle. In this case, we have just one limited partner. There could be 10, 20. Some fund-to-funds will literally have thousands of investors that feed into that vehicle.
Where would Pathways be on that page?
I'm sorry?
Where would Pathways be on that page?
We would be in that green box.
So you're the green box.
That manager, okay. The GP, yeah. And then you can see the portfolio that gets built beneath you. And if you have a portfolio of four or 500 companies, that's basically the S&P 500 index. You are properly diversified, and you can do that with 30 investments, roughly.
One of the big changes in our world, at least that I'm facing, is this new freedom of information request that we're getting. We come through and ask for detailed information. Is this all something that can be answered, or is it secret that you can't tell people? Or if somebody says on partnership number two, on company number H, tell me what it is, and we get a request, we can say, sure, it's whatever.
So I can't speak for the rest of the industry, but when we construct these on behalf of our clients, we negotiate with the limited partnership the ability to provide all underlying top-level information on each of these partnerships. So you'll have the ability to see how they performed, all the different return metrics. In terms of the underlying companies, this structure offers protection from that aspect.
No, I'm talking about we have a citizen who wants to know.
In terms of the underlying...
So it's public.
Yeah.
Because most of the stuff we do is public. So.
Yes, yes.
So we can say company H is a gardening shop or what?
We can provide that information. What the general partners are sensitive of is how those companies are being valued, because that ultimately affects their ability to sell and position that company in the marketplace.
So that becomes our administrator's problem and transvalue the whole thing. Yeah.
But
most of the public doesn't care about.
Yeah, disclosure
is a big issue,
and it's a very big issue on our part too. And we work hard to make sure that you have the information you need for requests like that.
Because when I first got into the concept in the industry, I was told there was a disclosure problem, that these people didn't want things disclosed. But now it's more open.
Absolutely, yeah. So we used to have issues with providing the underlying performance of these partnerships.
Right.
That was one of the
right.
That issue has become, we're not saying that like we have in the past.
Because we have to explain where we are every year.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, 30% of investments are from public pension funds. You guys know how to do that disclosure stuff.
Absolutely.
We're running into all sorts of disclosure problems. People sending in all sorts of really strange requests for information. The county council is telling us today it's becoming an issue.
And if you think about, you know, as Jason mentioned, fund of funds can provide some protection. As if you invest through a fund of funds, what would show up in your financial report would be one line. It would say, you know, fund of fund ABC, and it would have performance. It wouldn't have all of this underlying information. So
yeah, but that's why we get the requests for people to look.
That will be the public record.
Yeah, that's right. And it's difficult for people to, yeah. As opposed to if you have 30 funds, then they can then go to the fund's website and get the portfolios. And so it does add some extra level of information.
And what would be a minimum investment?
In a fund of fund like this, we can take five million in size.
That means you own a very, very small part of 100 companies? Or
yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it gives you that diversification that you're looking for, potentially.
That's pretty common what we see with other providers as well.
And size is one of the key determinants, typically, of the decision of do I build a direct portfolio or do I go a different route. And you know, one of the things we haven't mentioned is that many funds, if you're going to invest in buyout fund A or buyout fund B, they'll have minimums as well. So it can be difficult to build a portfolio unless you have a reasonable number, amount of money to put it to work. Page 21 kind of brings to life what a fund does. We won't go through all of these, but I know the number one top, the initial decision for you if you select a fund-to-fund partner is picking that partner. As we've talked about, it is a long-term relationship. You're talking 10 or 15 years, so that is the most critical part of this. And essentially, your fund-to-fund manager handles everything else. It's designed to be a turnkey solution. Keep it easy, one 10K or one 1K. And managing the audit, the investment, et cetera, et cetera.
So we decide to try and hire somebody for this. We would have to figure out how to separate out different classifications. Pathway is a fund manager of this kind versus some other kind? Or is there some characteristic that keeps you separate from 20 other fund-to-fund managers?
There are a large variety of fund-to-fund managers.
That's what
because there is so much capital in the private equity space, there is primarily a solution for all. You can take that global core approach where I'm going to invest in one manager and they're going to invest in the strategies for me. You can get a fund-to-fund that does just secondaries. You can get a fund-to-fund that does venture only or Europe only. So those will be decisions when you put your portfolio together with Ed and his team to think about.
I think what she's saying is the fund-to-fund structure helps with page 18. So page 18 has those boxes outlining all the functions that need to be done.
Yes.
And that's true. They all need to be done. I think what they're saying is with a fund-to-fund manager, they do all of them. Or most of it.
Well, I'm trying to think in terms of, okay, we're going to hire a fund-to-fund manager, we interview three or four. They all say the same thing? That doesn't make sense. There's some way to separate.
Well, they'll all perform these functions for us. I thought you were talking about internal staffing and what you would have to do there. So
no, that's a different question.
That's a different question.
No, it's just like some of the other things that we've gone through. Yeah. We bring several in. They don't usually all say the same thing. They have little nuances.
Right.
And we ferret out the nuance that we like the best.
But it's not as simple as, say, we deal with utilities and we deal with railroads and we deal with, you know, there's not, it's all over the place.
Yes.
I think we're overthinking it. We've already been through exactly the same thing. When we decided to do the direct lending, we ended up with a criteria that said, there's no leverage. In other words, we're not going to borrow any money, and everything has to be collateralized. And at the time, it was the investment manager. We said, bring us some people to interview.
Yeah.
They brought Medley and Raven
and
White Oak. And all three of those people met our criteria, had a little different strategy. So rather than throwing it all with one, we decided to take our $100 million and divided it up between three of them.
Okay.
And I think it would be very, very similar here. The only difference is, it could be the exact same group of folks that we're lending money to now. It could be those same companies, except we bought a piece of their action instead of lending them money.
Gotcha.
I'm even guessing the risk profile is pretty close to the same.
Well, this has a higher risk profile
okay.
because you're taking the equity stake. So.
Okay. So you can't get in and out on a fixed amount of time.
You don't get our money back very quickly.
Well, except that the money came back faster than we thought it was going to on the lending.
Yes.
And there probably are times when it may do that on...
But in general.
Yeah.
The risk profile is different because if that company goes bankrupt, the equity holders might die entirely. The debt holder gets a recovery based on whatever they can recover.
On what we're doing, we're going to get paid in cash. This, we could also get stock.
Yeah. And remember when we were surprised to find out that some of the times that they're lending money to them, they're also getting a warrant? So
yep.
they can end up with equity.
Yep.
My guess is there's all those other kinds of side benefits
yes.
or risks that go with what we're doing. But somehow we've been through the procedure somewhere.
Right. So we've been through the side letters. Are they similar or is there a difference?
They wouldn't know what our side letters look like.
Oh,
so.
Yeah. Sorry. That's right. Keep them time.
So we have a team of four lawyers in-house, and we also use external counsel. We negotiate for each one of our LPs their side letters so that for each one of the individual funds. So we have a process of doing that that we're very familiar with.
But like in our side letter, we don't want, as he said, no leverage or something.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
So we've talked about the fundamentals. Sorry, it was ambitious to get through it in 30 minutes, but we appreciate your time. It's a tough subject. There's lots more to say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was really very enlightening.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
So at this breaking point, do we want to take a 5 to 10 minute break?
Sure.
We're going to go to break. At 3:07, we're returning back into session.
All right. I have a question. we've decided to go into private equity, right?
No, we haven't made that
decision. Okay, we're still toying with that. Would having those investments require, or that classification of investment, require more staff or more board time than other investments that are in the portfolio?
So, no, not, well, yes, more. The answer is more, yes. Whether it's different, I don't know. I don't think so. But that is definitely a question that we need to discuss before we make a decision on the asset allocation. It's already on my plate to discuss with you guys. We have to discuss that because we don't want to get to a situation where you pick an asset allocation today and we got to come back to you 2 months later and say, hey, look, guys, you know, we don't know if we're going to be able to do this. And in fact, if we're going to talk about this, we can talk about this right now. I'm probably going to recommend to you today that we delay this decision for a couple months to give us a chance to go back and really get our hands around what's going to be needed to implement this. We knew before these guys got up there in front this was going to introduce another level of complexity and work for staff in this portfolio. So I think, like I said, what we're going to ask you today is hold on, let us go back and really get our arms around what it is we're going to need to be able to go down this path.
Can I ask you to be and careful, because we don't want to be like some of the other funds who were saying, we can't tell what we have and how much fees there are. We need to know we're doing it. We need staff to do it.
I agree. I mean,
I don't want to be in a position where we don't know.
That's why I don't want to even come back and say we're going to come back in a month from now. I want to couple months, 2-3 months to be able to really chew this over and figure out what it is we need. And we have the luxury of having Graham with a directive that we gave him in January that he can go back and follow, finalize the valuation.
Yeah.
Mandeep's already actually given county projected rates based on what we told Graham to do in January. So we do have at least 6 to 8 months of comfort to where before we actually make a decision. I know that's probably not what you want to hear, but it's definitely an important factor in the decision going forward.
Actually, it's fine and to be expected, because okay. I think anything we're talking about, we would be rebalancing the portfolio for one thing. We would be introducing new asset classes very likely, and probably doing some manager searches to fill those asset classes, and potentially looking at the existing lineup and seeing if there's anything we would recommend changing there. When you put that all together on a timeline of meeting monthly, how much can we get done in the next 6 months? We won't be there yet. It'll take the rest of this year to get that worked through. And then something like a private equity or the private credit strategies that we have, you know how they fund over time, so it's really years for full implementation. But I think to your point, or to Joan's initial question, what we're doing today to manage all of that and the complexity that we have in the portfolio now in terms of managing the cash flows of these strategies, managing the compliance and oversight, digesting the reporting that comes back to us, all of those things, that's a lot of work. And without a dedicated person doing that, that's hard to manage. And if we're looking at the complexity being incrementally higher, because all of the asset allocations we're talking about are incrementally more complex, it creates a higher burden, I think, on staff to do that. So I think it's a real challenge.
And what percentage of our portfolio are we talking about possibly committing to this asset?
So private equity, I think we could be somewhere between, at the low end, 180 million to 270 million. This is
so
between 10 and 15%, I believe.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So it's a substantial commitment to that asset class.
Okay.
And I think there's also some of these mixes that have an additional 5 to 10% to the private credit class. So we're looking at expanding that alternative class by somewhere between, I would say, $200 and $300 million,
yeah.
Which is
eventually
three times what we have dedicated to that class today.
Are you comfortable with the reporting you're doing now, or would you want to expand, or that's something you have to think about?
I'm never comfortable with the
okay.
that we're doing, and you can ask staff.
Neither am I.
Sorry.
Then you can think about what issue
yes.
you want to do.
I mean, I would always be wanting to do more and more if we can.
Okay.
So, Jim, okay. Are we back in
session? Yeah.
Okay. Can you grab that light?
And can I just ask one question as far as private equity? Do you feel like you had your questions answered? I know there was some back and forth and everything, but is everyone content that the questions were eventually
level,
answered?
Somewhere between the high level and doing it, we need to know more.
Okay. And I think that's a great answer because we have more to do on that. But.
Specifically, how do you choose people?
Okay, so what I wanted to do is talk for just 10 minutes. There's about 9 or 10 slides here. They're very simple to grasp, but I wanted to make sure that we all understood the concept of the functionally focused portfolio, which is one of the potential mixes for consideration. So in a nutshell, what the functionally focused portfolio does is you set aside money today to pay tomorrow's benefits that are due, your liabilities, your benefits that you have to pay. And what that allows you to do is that in times of stress, market stress, you don't have to tap other areas of your portfolio to be able to satisfy your benefit payments. Money that we don't reserve or set aside today to pay and fund benefits allows us to invest a little more aggressively with the rest of the portfolio, knowing that we can take comfort in the fact that our liabilities and benefit payments are covered. We don't have to worry about tapping other areas of the portfolio to cover that. Now, one thing, if you remember, you may not, there's several new board members here, but we actually discussed this concept in August of 2012. We brought this same concept to the board. I got a feeling that there was the board as a group looked upon this strategy very favorably, and in fact, we incorporated some of these ideas into our strategic plan. And so if the FFP, should we choose to go that route, would actually also fulfill that part of the strategic plan that we had talked about 3 or 4 years ago. I know you were pretty high on this concept yourself, Mike, but we have heard about this. This is nothing new. Another thing is there are a couple 37-inch counties that are actually going down this path. Contra Costa is one of them. I believe San Joaquin, Sarah, has actually started down exploring the idea of doing something along these lines. So this is the current state of affairs today. This is fiscal year 2014-2015. Our total benefits that we had to pay out during last fiscal year was $104.2 million. 76.8 of that million of that money came from an employer-employee contribution, went directly into paying those benefits, and the other 27.4 came from the sales of investments and investment income.
Those are actual numbers?
Those are actual numbers.
We would pay out $104 million a year.
$104.2 million.
So we're about 25% short.
That's the shortfall. Yeah.
And this is the entire system, right?
No, this actually...
Just the county.
Oh, yeah, it is. Sorry, benefit payments and refunds. So I thought it was just benefit payments. It's everything.
Yeah.
And admin expenses. So you're right. This is everything.
But for all employers,
all
not...
All employers.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah. All employers, not just the county. So the way we generate this liquidity today to cover that shortfall, the difference between the benefits paid and our contributions that we get from sponsors, that money mainly comes from our fixed income portfolio. Sometimes we use distributions once in a while, I imagine, if the timing's right, but no, Kathy says no. So everything is coming from the fixed income portfolio now. Although what we do today is we don't necessarily estimate what our long-term benefit payments are going to be, and so what we do, or what Kathy does, is she just sends Don or Cox an email and says, just give us this amount of money.
Quarterly.
Doing it that way is inefficient because we're not taking into account that we know when we can get some of this money based on our principal maturing and our bond coupons. There are specific times when these assets actually pay back, but so we're not taking advantage of the fact that we can know when we're going to get this money. And because of that, again, like we mentioned before, it could be in times of market stress that we could have to sell other assets to meet our benefit needs.
But then it's not reinvested to build the portfolio?
No, that money comes from Dodge & Cox directly in the form of coupons and principal maturation, and then we use that to
pay it out.
Okay.
So no new money is going into the plan, other than equity dividends and obviously other coupons and maturations from the rest of our fixed income portfolio. That's all being reinvested back in the plan. One of the things that's extremely that pension plans, and especially defined benefit pension plans, have an advantage on is our benefit payments are extremely predictable. And we don't necessarily take advantage of that because of the way we fund our cash shortfalls. And also, since lump sum cash outs aren't allowed, we don't have to worry about any runs in the bank. A retiree can't come to us and, you know, when he's 70 years old and say, I need you to give me $200,000, the value of my benefit. They can't do that. So just by the mere fact that all we have to worry about is future benefit payments, they're very, very easy to predict. And one of the ways, or one of the things we did, in May of 2013, we actually developed a statistically significant model with a high degree of reliability, and we used it to project our cash flows at that time, in May of 2013. So at that time, we, and for fiscal year 13-14, we actually predicted that we would have $92.3 million in benefit payments that we would have to satisfy. That actual amount came in at $93.3 million. For trying to project the fiscal year 2 years later, May 2013 for the 14-15 fiscal year, we were actually able to come within $460,000 of the actual benefit payments that we had to pay out. This is not necessarily any magical thing that we're able to do. It really leads back to the predictable nature of our benefits. They are extremely predictable, and because they are, it's something that pension funds can take advantage of and be as efficient as possible in terms of investing and paying benefits. So this is the FFP approach. What we're looking at doing is matching the timing of our bond cash flows with our benefits. It's an efficient way of doing things. We're able to be invested for as long as possible. We can have one of our fixed income portfolios create, like I said earlier, create cash flows that and maturate principal maturations that actually pay off really close to the time that we need them to pay our benefits. So we can keep those assets fully invested for as long as possible. And this allows us to earn the highest yield that we can on those types of assets. It allows us to match multiple years of projected benefits. So we can set aside money to fund 2, 3, 4 years of benefit payments this way. We've already talked about this. We don't have to tap other assets in period of stress, comfortably invest the rest of the portfolio more aggressively, I shouldn't say aggressively. And then also the liquidity that we would have, the inherent liquidity that this portfolio would, this liquidity portfolio could provide, would allow us to be more tactical at times. In other words, for short periods of time, we could take some of that money and use it if there were certain market events that were happening that we thought that we could make money on. That would be a short-term tactical play, but it allows us to do that should we want to. There are two options that we can consider. Option one would be to set aside all our benefit payments. In other words, set aside money in our fixed income portfolio with assets that pay off very close to the time when our benefit payments come due. And right now, we're looking at an average of about $110 million in payments a year. So consequently, 3 years of payments would be about $330 million that we would have to set aside. And that accounts for about 18% of our portfolio right now. Option two, which I think is, I think it's a little more smarter, is to set aside the shortfall. So we set aside our benefits less our expected contributions. Doing this, if our shortfall right now is averages about $30 million a year. So 3 years of shortfall is $90 million compared to the $330 million of shortfalls if we set aside all our benefit payments. And those shortfalls for 3 years represent 5% of the portfolio.
Does this get affected at all if you had a change in your expected shortfall?
Payroll?
No. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, well, but when we show the contribution,
right,
our projections, they're expected to increase by 30% or more over the next 3 years.
Absolutely.
So that would reduce that shortfall, at least in years two and three, to maybe zero.
You think it's going to go that low?
Well, like I said,
well, either way,
bearer of bad news.
Either way. Right. That would be fantastic, though.
As long as the baby boomers don't retire.
If we can get all our cash flows from our
well, if, I mean, I partly, you know, I brought the projection so we can show what the potential impact of the down year for fiscal year 16 might look like. We
which case you might not be cash flow negative.
But I mean, we can't, yes, I hear what you're saying. This is more regarding theory and how we might implement something like this. Absolutely. And that's what makes option two, where I'll talk about that, a little less efficient. Option one is more efficient because it's very easy to predict the benefit payments. We know what they're going to be, and we can set aside enough to pay for those. Cash flow errors would be minimized, kind of what Graham's talking about. We don't know really what's going to happen in 2 to 3 years. And there would be more opportunity for these types of tactical decisions since there would be more money in the liquid bucket. There is less flexibility with the illiquid portfolio. Less money would be dedicated to riskier assets. And consequently, you could have potential for higher employer contributions because more of that money is dedicated to these low-risk assets. Option two, if you move down to the not as efficient, exactly what Graham said, it's much more difficult to predict contributions, and not just because of payroll, it's mentioned up there, but because we don't know what's going to happen in terms of the market events. And so it definitely is not as efficient, and it's harder to do in terms of predicting what those shortfalls we're going to need. There are ways to mitigate that. We don't have to go into that right now. There is more flexibility with the illiquid portfolio. I think there's greater diversification opportunities. If you have less money being dedicated to paying your shortfall, that gives you more money to use for diversification if you want to. If there's other ways that you want to diversify the rest of the portfolio, I think it gives you greater opportunities. And, of course, you have potentially lower employer contribution rates. And finally, this is kind of what the flow of funds approach would look like. You can see that there's no line between the traditional portfolio in the upper left connected to the rest of the diagram. That would be the one that we would, I don't want to say manage independently, but we could manage without having to worry about having to cap that at unpredictable times.
So the only difference that you're projecting would be a duration thing? You'd allocate that fund and then have a duration that would match your need.
Exactly. On the little green ball.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. That's pretty much, I didn't want to get into any details here, but that's pretty much the concept of the functionally focused portfolio. I just wanted to make sure that we were all on board with the way it works. That's all I have.
So, Rick, it's kind of like a just-in-time, kind of like an inventory concept where you time your maturities of the fixed investments to coincide with your cash needs.
And the timing of the
cash as well, right?
Okay, that's it.
No decisions needed?
No. Okay. I just want you to keep that in the back of your mind when you're talking about the asset mixes in the future.
Okay, so after that is setting of the 2016-2017 employer contribution rates.
So let me say something first. So what we're going to try to do here is we're going to try to get Graham and Ed to coincide here and talk about the asset allocation decision and the effect of the asset allocation decision on the actuarial assumptions that Graham is going to go back and use. So that's why these two items that are under that category are kind of Roman numeral 1 and Roman numeral 2, so we can discuss both of these issues at the same time.
Okay.
Sorry, Jeff.
So I think I'm Roman numeral 1.
I don't see an H. Don't pull rank.
It was awkward silence. I felt for some reason. Can you take one? Wait, isn't that a Susan?
That's a problem.
It is. What I'm handing out is slightly different than what you received in the materials, only because it was updated with balances as of yesterday. Or the day before, actually. I did it yesterday, so it was the day before. Which, minor change I can point out to you. But this is a rebalancing spreadsheet. Apologies for the small font. It's just a function of how much we have going on in the portfolio. And this is a follow-up to our last meeting when we took a look at the performance of the plan. And part of that is we looked at the asset allocation and we noticed that we're significantly overweight and underweight certain asset classes. And I said, I'd recommend that we bring back a rebalancing analysis for you to consider. And so this is that analysis. And so what we have in the spreadsheet going down the left-hand side is the asset classes and the individual strategies for each. The next column over is the actual dollar amounts and the percent of the portfolio allocated to each of them. This is drawn from the custodian as of March 15th. Beside that, we have the targets. And you'll see in bold, these are targets that are specifically identified in the investment policy statement. And then the breakdown below that. So for example, we have U.S. equities at the top. The target is 38.2%. And that's made up of the large cap value, 14.4, large cap growth, 11.3, large cap core, 4.8, and small cap value at 4.0, and small cap growth at 3.7. Those are the components that add up to that 38.2. Working across the next column, we have the ranges, the acceptable ranges as defined in the investment policy statement. So you can see across the board, we are currently within, which is good because the last performance report, we were actually above the max on the U.S. equities side, which was part of the driver of why we said, whoa, this isn't just out of alignment with your target. It's actually pushing the max boundary. So we're a little bit below that, you know, the correction in January and the U.S. equity markets defined that. The rebalance columns in the black box there, the first column is just what the spreadsheet calculates specifically in terms of getting this plan perfectly in balance. Here would be the numbers, and it gets a little bit tedious to do all strategies to the exact dollar amount, and you can never perfectly time it anyhow. So we have the recommended column, which basically rounds it off to the nearest 5 million. So you can see that essentially this rebalancing is taking 100 million from U.S. equities, allocating 10 million of that to non-US equities, allocating 65 million to fixed income, and 20 million to alternatives, specifically real estate, because we are the most underweight there. The next columns show what the new allocation would be.
On the real estate, what's the target there mean?
The real estate target is 3.5. We're currently at 2.2, and this would bring us to 3.3. So we would still be 20 basis points below on real estate exposure.
Okay, I'm getting a little lost. Maybe it's just me. If I go BlackRock, real estate is the one you're putting it in. Is that the right one?
Yes. So it's the most liquid strategy. So it's easy to actually invest the 20 million there.
Oh, okay.
There.
So you're putting it there and it can be moved later if needed.
That's right.
Gotcha.
That's right. Exactly. And then on the columns to the right there, the new column is what the new balances would be after the recommended column were to be implemented. And then the variance column shows us how far we are out of balance with our policy, with targets. And so you can see that as a result, the alternative is underweight by 3.9%. And that's because we're waiting for the calls on the direct lending side and infrastructure side. Those take time. So we're going to be underweight there. And in the meantime, the overweights then are spread across U.S. equities. We maintain a 1.7% overweight to U.S. equities, a 0.9% overweight to international equities, and a 1.1% overweight to fixed income. So we're spreading out where we are overweight across the rest of the portfolio, but generally in line with the policy. Okay. Also, all of these movements are an incremental step towards all of the asset allocations that we showed you at the last meeting. So it's not like we're allocating more to something that we would then anticipate having to pull back. These are all incrementally in the right direction. I think the exception would probably be fixed income. We would probably pull that back, but that has the lowest trading costs associated with it. So that's why that would be the purposeful overweight there until we make our decisions.
All right, so on the non-U.S. equities, you're recommending $10 million more?
Yes.
And what is the, because we're 4.9 million short?
That's right. So we're actually currently underweight. But because we're going to underweight all the alternatives, we have to hold other weights in other portions of the portfolio. So allocating $10 million here gets us above the target by 0.9%.
So Ed, you said that this move is good not only for our current allocation, but also any prospective mix that the board chooses to go into. We're heading in the right direction either way.
That we've contemplated so far, yes.
Right. And is that mainly due to the overweight in U.S. equities?
Yes. Yes. I think every alternative that we showed brings down U.S. equities significantly.
But this will be a decision that we have to decide today, no matter what, whether we want to start the rebalancing process towards.
Is this easy or difficult, or are there any concerns?
It's easy for me, but I'll let Kathy answer that.
We've actually reached out to Northern Trust. Northern Trust would handle the transition. And so it's easy for me because Northern Trust is going to handle it.
So it's not hard for anybody at the table.
There is a cost
associated to it, absolutely. But,
I understand the rebalancing theory and minimizing risk and all this, but there is I just have an instinctive reaction to taking money out of U.S. equities and putting it in the international. I don't think the other places in the world are going to do it as well as we do. Or I think they will do it more poorly than we do.
Do you think
this is not a Bible that we're working on.
No.
This is the word of the Lord.
That's a good point, though, because it is consistent with our economic outlook. And so last quarter when we presented you with our macroeconomic outlook, part of the key statistics in there were the valuations in U.S. equities, not only from a price-to-earnings ratio where they're about 16, and that's higher than the 5- and 10-year average, but also because the earnings have had three sequential quarters of decline year over year. That's the first time we've seen that since 2009. The first quarter 2016 is continuing that trend. The analyst estimates are down 8% there. So,
in U.S. equities.
In U.S. equities, yeah. So that's that. There's a difficult story there for U.S. equities. Not that that can't change, obviously, and not that the markets can't rally up despite those numbers.
And what's the situation internationally?
Internationally, it's much better because we're seeing that the valuations there have come down. And so particularly emerging markets look more attractive than international developed, but international developed look more attractive than U.S. along those same metrics.
I share Mike's concern, and I think part of the reason is there are a lot of factors going on which aren't historical, whether you talk about Brazil with the virus thing and talk about Russia with its economic problems and stuff. Feels like there's dangers everywhere in the world.
Everything you read says people are investing here, people from overseas. We don't read that we're taking money out of the United States and putting it in Peru. You know, we're not reading those articles. So what am I missing here?
Well, that is happening. So international investing is definitely happening. So I think
you mean picking
part
up.
Of that. I'm sorry? Picking
it's
up.
Picking up.
I don't have a good statistic on whether it's picking up or not. I think the anecdotal evidence that Chinese markets are volatile, Chinese investors are looking to the U.S. and buying U.S. real estate, and that's a key driver of what we're seeing in our real estate markets. That's true. That's kind of a one-off anecdotal story, though. To find a trend out of that and to really say that that's the driver.
I just want to see a trend that says more people are investing in foreign markets than in American markets. And if you say it's because the valuation over there has gone down lower than the valuations over here, well, there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
Because they're switching governments every other week. I don't think that you take out of the one and give to the other just because.
Mm-hmm. Well, a key.
I want more than just. I mean, give me the non-anecdotal evidence.
Well, a key driver of it is when you take a look at the quantitative easing that we did here in the U.S. and how our equity markets responded to that pretty dramatically. We are now out of the quantitative easing game, and in fact, our Fed is talking about raising rates, has done so once, and is talking about what will happen this year. The story is very different internationally, both in Japan with Abenomics and with European Central Bank and Draghi, and they are very stimulative right now. So if we think about it from that perspective.
With negative interest rates and everything, you think it's stimulative?
They've gone negative.
That is stimulative. That's as easy monetary policy as you can
get.
But
they're finding people are keeping the money rather than doing something with it as expected. So they're not getting the reaction they expected.
They're pushing on it. So it's interesting.
I know they're pushing.
Well, so what they've done is they've created an incentive to not save. If people are saving, then that's a sign of how scared they are. But they'll recognize that that negative return is not going to pay their bills tomorrow, so they're going to have to go out the yield curve, which is what happened here. So it really pushes everyone out of the in-the-mattress kind of approach. I have to buy something that actually produces income, and I have to take investment risk. So it's a blessing.
Can you talk about the context of U.S. equity asset class, international equity asset class, and how it fits into the overall structure of the portfolio in terms of risk reward and what it is we're doing?
Yes, great point. So when we take a look at the asset allocation structure that we looked at with you last time, bless you, there are the return expectations and the risk expectations, and those aren't dramatically different international versus U.S. There is emerging market as well. That is a notch higher on risk return. There's also the correlation between the two. And so there's a pretty high correlation, but the correlation is not one. And therefore, anytime the correlation is not one, there's a benefit to diversifying the assets because there's the ups and downs do not perfectly coincide. The idea in doing so is to create a portfolio that has more muted volatility in the ups and downs. That's a really key concept for a pension plan because when there are ups and when there are downs, regardless of what's happening, you still have to pay the benefits. And so if the downs happen and you have to pay the benefits, then you have less capital base to earn the recovery whenever you have the recovery. And so we work really hard to mute those returns. So it's not just a case of best risk return profile, it's also the correlation between the assets that's really important. Is that responsive to your question?
Questions regarding the proposed rebalance that you have before you? Because I think this is something that can be discussed independently of where we're going to go with the asset allocation.
That's true, too.
So we're going to need a vote on this regardless.
I mean, so what the motion before us is to just reallocate as this?
Correct.
Do you want to wait on the vote until after Graham says his part, or do you want to take the vote now?
Well, no, because I think you want to do this regardless, right?
Yes. Yes.
So I don't think it really matters what Graham has to say.
Sorry.
Never die. Wow, that was smart.
All right, Graham, we love you.
You're all going to die.
And you have tables to prove it.
Well, I'm comfortable going with the guy that we hired to know more than us on his recommendation.
I am comfortable with that too. If I can have some non-anecdotal evidence, we have the anecdotal evidence that says people from all over the place are investing here. We all know ourselves that other than tax havens, which I'm not in the category of taking advantage of, but maybe Jim is. But other than tax havens, none of us would invest in any of these countries except possibly Norway. Other than the United States, none of us. So we wouldn't put our own money.
I would invest in Japan. I would invest in Germany. I'd invest in France. Scandinavia.
And even England. There was a map in the Wall Street Journal today that showed inflation rates and potential growth rates. And Britain was better than... I'm going, Britain's this big, you know, but...
All I'm saying, the analytics, I don't believe in changing for the sake of maintaining... A ratio which I don't see any justification.
Mike, you want to take money
are you
going to
be able to vote today, even though we won't have any support or evidence?
Some emerging markets.
Today?
No,
I mean,
others just in U.S. non-equity.
But you could. So are you going to vote or are you going to abstain?
Okay. It's over here.
Okay.
It is interesting how those, the bad news creates the opportunities. I think we were just at Caliper, several people at the table were just at the Calipers conference, and one of the anecdotes was about the recovery in the Brazil equity market being 45% year to date or something like that. And it's one of those eye popping things, like, really, Brazil? I mean, every headline you read out of there is Rousseff is being impeached. Yeah, that's right. That's right. But it's another one of these stories, and the Brazil story happens over and over again because we watched it happen in Greece, we watched it happen in Italy. That these are places I wouldn't, yeah.
60 million was a significant. Here's 20 million.
I know there's money in the alternative funds. I just don't think you should add
it's quite a bit in this.
I'm against it.
Yeah. Which is no risk at all.
Madam Chair, I'll make the motion that we accept the strategic asset allocation that's proposed by our consultant as presented.
I'd like to modify that to rebalancing.
Rebalancing, yeah. I'm sorry. Rebalancing. Use the wrong word.
Is there a second?
Yes, sir.
Okay, can we have a roll call vote?
Yes. Can I ask a question?
Oh.
Kathy, you said there'd be some costs associated with this.
Yes.
You got some idea of what we're talking about?
I do. Go ahead.
I would estimate, based on the information we got back from Northern Trust and based on an allocation or a proposed rebalance that was a little bit different than this, I would estimate between $600,000 and $700,000.
To do
that's everything. Now, that's also implicit cost, opportunity cost in the market, which are things that aren't tangible, you can't see. In other words, the cost that you incur by trying to sell a large portfolio in the market and not being able to sell for what the price is when you first enter the market, that's called an opportunity cost.
You have to take whatever's there.
Exactly, but sometimes you have to sell your portfolio when it gets to be this large over a specified period of time. You just cannot go out, click a button, and sell $100 million of security. So it has to be done over time. And the fact that it takes time creates opportunity
when you first enter
when you first enter the market.
So how long does it take us to recover those costs?
That depends on how well the assets do after.
Then why bother?
Because right now you're out of line with your policy, pretty significantly. Your last rebalancing was done in 2011.
But what we're doing is working.
No, because what you're doing is you're divorcing from the analysis and the intent of what your asset allocation is, and you've now taken a 4-going-on-5-year tactical bend away from that. So that is not recommended.
The key here is understanding that we're not getting the full diversification potential that we can from our current asset allocation. And when things don't go so well in the equity market, we're probably going to suffer more relative to our peers, I'm assuming.
You will. And in fact, I guess another way of answering that is we're going to take a look at the asset allocation in a moment, and we model out your policy and your current, and both of them have the same expected return. Your current has higher volatility with greater drawdown risk in it.
Greater
drawdown risk.
How much, again, did you say this was going to cost us?
I'm going to say between $600,000 and $700,000. Explicit costs, transaction fees, and opportunity costs, which aren't tangible, but they exist.
Why so much more in the fixed income? That's you're recommending...
That's a good question.
So that's...
I mean, that seems like it's out of line.
Yeah. It's with intent. So it recommends adding about 46 million. This recommends going 65. So again, this is part of the overweight that because we aren't fully funding the alternatives, and we can't until they call the capital, that we have to hold other overweights in the other parts of the portfolio. So this is one part of that. It also syncs up well, though, because the underweights that we have are in direct lending. So this is bond-like instruments to private companies. They behave like bonds. The best proxy we have in the portfolio today is the fixed income exposure, going to Dodge & Cox, which is your credit manager.
So you'd move out of there when they call it in the alternatives?
Exactly.
So that's the reason.
So why wouldn't you just leave it where it is and then sell it when you're ready to move it?
Because we still need to rebalance.
And most of it is an equity.
We're out of policy. when we were, before we lost the nearly $100 million to where we are now, what was our percentage of equities in the U.S. equities? See, now it's at 45.7. What was it before the stock market went down?
So it was above the 47.7, and it comes out as a no on the performance report.
Yeah. Did you remember how high that was?
I think I can pull that up.
So like right now, if we didn't do anything and the stock market rebounded, which it will sometime, we would go back out of compliance. I'm just asking if you remember how much it was.
It rebounds about every third day.
That would be good for us because they would be making money for us.
If it goes down another click
right.
equal to what we just did, and then what was that loss compared to our $600,000 of change?
Yeah.
If we had everyone lost money in 2008. This fund lost a bunch of money in 2008. Did we make money on the international equities?
I don't know.
Let me ask you this. If we experienced another 2008 event, Ed, would you rather be in our actual allocation or would you rather be in your recommended rebalance?
Recommended rebalance.
And why is that?
Because the downside is all on the equity side. This reduces that into diversified.
This is not about that. This is about, in my mind, this is about domestic with alternatives. This is within the equity market.
But so I guess I mentioned it earlier. I'm going to have trouble finding that number. I might be able to do it, but it'll take me a little bit of work. The current portfolio, right.
But the recommended increase in non-U.S. equities is only $10 million. For us, that's really not very
much. Most of that is going into fixed income and real estate. We're actually removing $90 million from the equity portfolio, not 190, because 10 of it's going into international, as you suggest. So most of it's going into fixed income and real estate. Mm-hmm.
Right. 16-20.
Is there an advantage in moving from Dodge & Cox to Dodge & Cox versus others? Because, it seems like we're just... Maybe that's not so expensive.
Well, that's the benefit of using a transition manager. Northern Trust is their transition management team, and they do go look for the least expensive way to do this. And Verus has vetted several transition managers. Their research team has. They recommended we look into Northern Trust. We reached out to Northern Trust, and with that and the information we used when we did one with BlackRock a couple years ago, they're right in line with what the going rate is out there. And because we're already a customer of Northern Trust, there are some fees we won't have to pay.
You can't just call up Dodge & Cox and ask them to switch it without charging a lot?
They don't hold the securities. All those securities are held.
I give up.
All the securities are held at the custody bank.
Yes, they may not be experts at execution strategy and minimizing opportunity costs, which I think Northern Trust would be.
That's the point. Or that's one of the key points of using a transition manager. That's right. Okay.
We'll call for the question, please. We've got a vote on the floor.
Can I just ask one question before we take the vote? Now, the asset allocation study that we're trying to pin down, will there be another rebalancing as a result of that? So, I'm just wondering, can we save the 700 and do just one rebalancing?
So there will be an implementation plan that will likely include, depending on where we land, a rebalancing to get closer to that, and then continued work to get new managers in and what have you to get it really built out as the entire portfolio. So there will be continued transition, but the $600,000 to $700,000 of transition cost which I haven't seen, but certainly take Rick's word for it. That dollar amount is well spent because each of these asset allocations is an incremental step, or I'm sorry, this rebalancing is an incremental step towards any of those asset allocations. So it's in the right direction.
So, we need to go in there anyway.
Yeah, it's not like we'd be investing in LSV and then pulling back out of LSV or something like that.
So after we've done this major rebalancing, that portion would be much more, the movement will be much less.
Just the opposite. This is going to be very small. The other one's very big.
Yeah.
We're doing some of the legwork now.
Yeah, we're doing some of the legwork now, basically.
Okay, are we ready for the vote?
The motion before the board is, a motion was made by Trustee O'Neill and seconded by Trustee Sharp to approve the rebalance as presented. Trustee DeMartini?
Aye.
Trustee O'Neill?
Yes.
Trustee Grover?
Yes.
Trustee Riley?
Yes.
Trustee Dillon?
Yes.
Trustee Lynch?
No.
Trustee Ford?
No.
Trustee Sharp?
Yes.
Motion passes.
6-2.
6-2.
All right. So the next part, Roman numeral 2.
I think we should start talking about mostly discussion, I think. I don't feel that we're ready to make a decision specifically on the asset allocation. Of course, you guys can decide otherwise if you wish. But I think, again, if you are comfortable with the notion that staff, unless you know for sure you're not going to go in the direction of a new asset allocation or a new asset mix, I think the idea of coming back to you in a few months and giving you an idea of what it's going to require to implement and maintain the mix before you, then we can put that specific choice on hold for right now. But that doesn't preclude us from answering any questions, and if there are other issues, if you feel that you need more education before you can make a decision, to me, again, what I would say is that we need to make sure that we give you a clear picture of what is going to be entailed here. But if there are other things that you need from us to help you make a decision on the asset allocation in the future, we'd like to hear those right now.
Well, wouldn't asset allocation have something to do with rebalancing?
Yes, and that's what we decided just a little while ago, that this rebalance that the board agreed to pushes us in the direction of not only potential mixes that are on the table for your consideration, but also getting us closer in line to what our current asset allocation is. Should the board perhaps choose either not to go down the path of the new mix and stay with what we have? So either way, the rebalancing was necessary to get us closer to where we need to be right now, regardless of what path we go down in the future.
Okay.
Any other issues on potential asset mixes? Do you want to wait for a few months? Do you want to make a decision today? Do you have any questions for Ed about any of the mixes?
I think you need the time to come up with what you need. So I'd rather wait.
I'm not ready today.
Okay. Anything else, though, that we can do other than trying to figure out what the implementation cost and the ongoing diligence cost would be? Is there any other thing that you might need?
Well, I think both Mike and I have an issue that you can probably take a look at, which is the U.S. versus foreign, because the allocation is essentially giving what, twice as much to foreign as it to U.S. somewhere in that neighborhood.
Yes. Well,
and if we, because of our emotional feeling, feel the U.S. is a safer, that there's an awful lot of problems out there in the national, it's good to counter that with some reasons, because what I'm looking at are things that don't show up in past statistics. I'm talking about what we're seeing in the real world. In other words, if there's a virus and or a danger in going to the Olympics, people are afraid and not taking airplane flights. That's something you see today that has nothing to do with the past.
Right.
And so, you know, when you start seeing the negative interest rates that are happening in other countries, that is creating some level of fear. When you see those other things, you start saying, wait a minute. And then you find yourself being a nationalist saying, I'm going to only stay in my own country, which is probably not smart, but it's an emotional feeling. So you got to counter it with some logic.
It's what U.S. investors do. It's what Canadian investors do. It's what Japanese investors do. They invest the bulk of their assets in their home country. That's right.
No, what's happening right now is there's a huge flight to the United States for treasuries. It's disrupting the treasury market. It's making it very chaotic. And that's because they're running for safety because they're afraid.
So I think we can move the ball forward a little bit. We're not prepared to answer that.
Right. Well, I was going to say, yes.
So we can come back to that. Yeah.
Well, but there is... There always seems to be opportunity in chaos. People probably have made more money out of chaos than they have, you know, anything else. You know, if they pick the right stuff.
That's right. Buy low, sell high. The presentation that you have before you today, I don't need to go through it page by page, and certainly in the interest of time, I won't. But I think this ties in nicely with Rick's presentation about a functionally focused portfolio approach. And I think there are three key components to that approach. And I think Rick hit on the first one, which is really thinking through the plan's liquidity needs. And so he was highlighting the shortfall concept. Understand what your contributions are and your payments, identify what that shortfall is, and think about how we manage that shortfall. That was one option, and the other option was just the flat out, take X number of year of payments and just put that. That's a really key concept, because if you embrace that and you think about what would we want to do there, do we like the shortfall approach and do we want to do it for some period of time and what would that period of time be? That helps us think through how much of the portfolio needs to be invested in very safe assets, because we would want those to be very low volatility, there when we need them, very liquid, but certainly generating some return for us. Once we come up with what that component of the portfolio is, that allows us then to then think about the other two components, one being the growth. Where do we look for growth in the portfolio, like private equity, like private credit, real estate, international investing, emerging markets, all those kinds of asset classes? They're volatile, we know that, but over the long run, we expect to get higher returns for investing there. What do we want to do with that portion of the portfolio? And the third portion is, what can we do to dampen the volatility of that? Because the growth portion is going to be have some pretty significant ups and downs, what else can we invest in that might help offset some of that? Maybe real estate, maybe commodities, maybe risk parity, maybe hedge funds. I know I threw out two or three taboo words there, so I'm not going to advocate those, but those are the kinds of things that can help offset some of that volatility. So what this is doing here today, this presentation, basically takes the shortfall concept, saying, okay, what if we had shortfall, and what if we wanted to have 7 years of shortfall protection? And the reason I picked seven in this case is that's basically a full market cycle. That's a full up and down and recovery in a market cycle, 7 years, typically, historically. So, yeah, every time's different. But
what's typical?
Yeah, fair question. If we use that as the metric, then here's how we would create the portfolio, which is shown on page 6. And also page 7, just structured differently in terms of how they're grouped, with the actual results on page 8. And you can see that page 8 does have some pretty attractive characteristics. So even though 7 years of shortfall is essentially reserved within the portfolio, that leads us to have about 15% of the portfolio in short-term government credit bonds or fixed income cash. We have another 9 to 14% in diversifying assets, and the rest in the higher growth assets leads to page 8 with some attractive numbers in terms of forecasted 10-year returns, 7.3, 7.2. You'll see the standard deviation is in line or lower than with our current policy. Higher Sharpe ratio. So there are some interesting characteristics. And the difference between Portfolio A and Portfolio B is that Portfolio A does not have any risk parity, does not have any hedge funds in it. And so I think the last time we discussed this, part of the issue was that we weren't crazy about hedge funds at all, and we weren't sure about private equity. So we did an education session on private equity as well as risk parity, so hit those two education sessions. Also an education session on emerging markets. And both of these options have dialed down emerging markets from where we were previously. So these are more in line with what you would get with your existing mandates with LSV and Pyramus. So I think this demonstrates some of the flexibility we can bring to the table. And as we have these discussions about what we like, don't like, where our comfort level is, implementation, complexity, costs, and all those kinds of things, we can start modeling those in. So
Graham, did you want to show us what we may be looking at if we go with option one? It sounds like we're going to walk away from here today with no different direction for Graham. That he's going to continue to consider the current asset allocation until such time that the board makes a decision on where we want to go. And Graham is prepared to just let you know what the implications of that are.
Yeah, so I forwarded the shortest presentation I've ever, PowerPoint set of slides I've ever given anybody. There's really only one slide on here that, that has information on it.
Your popularity is going way up right
now. wait till I'm finished.
you can only go down from here.
Oh, okay. I know. Okay. So what we have here, the top row, was your the baseline contribution rates before we made any of the assumption changes. Right, so the average employee contribution rate was 9.35. Normal cost, the employer normal cost rate, that's the cost of the benefits that people are earning this year that aren't covered by the employee contributions, 10.94. Administrative expense assumption of 0.87. The amortization of the unfunded liability, so the payment to make up the shortfall in the assets, is 10.24. Total employer contribution rate is 22.05%. Remember, that's actually lower than the current year's contribution rate. The current year contribution rate, I think, is 23.35.
Yep.
Right. So it actually went down because of deferred investment gains. Remember when we did the preliminary results, you had a, you know, you didn't make your benchmark this year, but in prior years you exceeded it, and when you smoothed in those asset gains, it actually reduced the contribution rate this year. And then we get into the assumption changes, right? So the big ones were mortality rates, had some retirement rate changes, some salary changes. Those things increase the contribution rates, but the biggest factor is reduction in the assumed rate of return. And what we talked about, if you look at Harris' information, their assumption of the 10-year return is 6.3 under the current portfolio. Mm-hmm. That's with a 2% inflation assumption. So their assumption is that with your current portfolio, you earn something around 4.25% above inflation over this 10-year period. If you look at your current assumption of 7.75 with a 3.25% inflation assumption, you're assuming, or sorry, with 3% inflation assumption, that would be a 4.75 real rate of return. So much higher than what your investment consultant thinks that they can earn on your current allocation. So what the board adopted at the last meeting was, based on the current allocation, sorry, two or three meetings ago at this point, with the current allocation, the assumption you adopted was 7.25% nominal rate of return. That includes a 3% inflation assumption and a 0.25% for wage growth. So the wages would grow at 3.25%. Based on that, that would increase the contribution rate by the employer contribution rate by 8.81% versus the baseline. And what we didn't have for you last time was, well, we knew that this would have some impact on the employee contribution rates as well, right? So changing those assumptions would lead to an average change in the employee rate from 9.35 to 9.92. So that offsets a small portion of the increase that otherwise is felt by the employer. Right, so the employer's change ends up being 8.81%, so up to 30.86. What we also talked about was, well, one of the things that under the California Actuary Advisory Panel, they said when you've got some big assumption changes, it's hard for this plan sponsor to absorb those in a single year. You shouldn't let that discourage you from using assumptions that you think are reasonable. So, you know, one alternative, and that's it's made easier from the government accounting standards changes, but one thing you could do would be to smooth in the impact or phase in the impact of those assumption changes on the contribution rates. What we
present
on the employer.
Not employee, employee.
The employee rates are harder to phase in because they are actually based
on
the law, right? There's something in the law that says, based on your assumptions, what contribution rate is necessary to fund this kind of a benefit. Or for PEPRA, it's what's half the normal cost? Well, the normal cost is based on your current assumptions. Right? So in this case, we actually showed two alternatives. What would be the impact if you phased in the impact of the assumption changes on the total contributions for the employer versus what happens if we just phase in the impact on the unfunded liability payment? I've seen systems do it both ways. From an actuarial perspective, I tend to favor the UA just phasing in the UAL payments. The reason for that being, look, it's nice for you to be paying the normal cost, the cost of the benefits that people are earning this year, right? That's the normal cost. So to phase that in means that you're not going to be at least covering the cost of the benefits that people are earning with this year's service. Now, that's really sort of an artificial distinction. The total rate is what it is, right? You add up all the pieces to get to the whole. I just think there is some sort of theoretical reasoning for why you would focus on phasing in an unfunded liability payment as opposed to the normal cost as well. And that's the approach that, for instance, CalPERS has taken with their new direct rate smoothing methods that they're using. However, if you're only phasing in the increase in the unfunded liability payments, it does mean a slightly higher contribution rate for the plan sponsor because you're not phasing in a portion of the increase in the normal cost. You're making them absorb that all at once. So what we've shown here is if you phase in everything, it means instead of the normal cost that you ask the employer to pay going from 10.94 to 12.24, it would go to 11.37. Versus this second alternative where you just phase in the UAL payments, you're saying, okay, pay me the full normal cost this year. Same thing for administrative expenses. You could either say, okay, so instead of going from 0.87 to 0.96, you could just go to 0.9 or 0.96. Obviously, that one doesn't have as much of a difference. The unfunded liability is the same under either scenario. So instead of absorbing that almost 7.5% increase all at once, you would only absorb about 2.5% of that increase. So the unfunded liability would go from about 10.25 to about 12.7. So the total contribution rate, if you phased everything in over a three-year period, would be about 25% of pay. If you phased in just the unfunded liability changes, it would be just under 26%. Remember, the current year contribution rate is 23.35%.
And whether this matters or not, when he was here in January, we didn't talk about the differences between phasing in the total amount versus the unfunded liability. And Mandy, when I talked to Mandy about this, we both of us went back and we did some projections based on Graham's work and we've given them to the county, but it was based on phasing the entire amount in. So what I did before the meeting today is I looked at what the difference was, and I'm figuring that our projections that we gave the county were about 0.3% to 0.5% too low because we assumed that we were going to phase in the entire amount. Again, I don't know if that matters to you. Maybe Mandy could weigh in if that's a big deal or not to you.
I think now putting the county hat on, you know, from the county perspective, unfortunately, Mr. Jody Hayes, who's, you know, one of our senior executives, was not able to attend today because of a scheduling conflict because we changed the meeting day. We favor all phased in, all the elements phased in. We would rather have a smooth, you know, more like a levelized approach, you know, in the next 2 to 3 years, rather than taking all the hit right now. So, and that would mean, just for the county side, that would mean with the smooth in of both the elements would mean like 2.3 million on the general fund. Total county wide, it would mean $5.3 million. So, you know, I'll be I'll be favoring the smooth approach.
Graham, when we first started this whole thing about the 7.25, you were, I don't know how to say it politely, kind of strong about the fact that at 7.75 you couldn't really give us a acceptable, clean, I don't know what words you want to use, report. And we're talking about a 7%. You kind of agreed that if we went to 7.25, you could live with it.
Yeah, there's so Harrison, the only ones that make projections about the expected rates of return. If you remember, we
right.
had a presentation of there's this firm called Verizon that does a survey.
Right.
And the average of the survey is, you know, higher than Verisk's expectations. So there's a reasonable, there's a range of expectations.
Well, my concern there is that as we go forward, if life doesn't change, we may have to lower that number more to the 2%. Phasing in 3 years means we wouldn't do that for another 3 years to even talk about it.
Not necessarily. You have the ability to come back and make assumption changes with every valuation.
I guess I'm feeling squeezed, I don't want to say by you, by the mathematics and by what you were saying of what's acceptable. And if we keep delaying it, you know, it's great. But does that put us in a position where you again have a feeling that we may not be acceptable? Is that a right word?
So you're making moves in the right direction,
right?
Right? You're
making and the question is, how small a move can we make and still be okay?
Right. Again, I'm not going to have a problem signing a report with a 7.25% expected rate of return. I mean, it would be kind of crazy not to, given that everybody, you know, not that it matters what everybody else is doing, but 7.25 is the lowest of all the 20, you know, you'd be,
okay.
I think, eight other systems using a 7.25% rate of return.
So what I'm really asking is, you're comfortable with that and also the phasing
the
in?
Phase, yeah, the phasing is an acceptable and reasonable approach.
Where do we rate? I mean, if we're within the best of the 37 Act counties on the 7.2, where are we on the 30.86?
You're on the lower end.
So give me some examples.
Because you have a higher funded ratio than some of the other systems. So like,
what's my sense?
Oh.
Well, no, this is what
almost 50% of pay.
Okay, so their contribution rate is
50.
And what is selling?
I have to go back and look, but I think I know their safety plan is up in the 70s.
So that 30 is
lower is
much Fresno.
Ask about Sonoma.
Let's see, SJ's, you know what?
Who has a $500 million obligation bond.
When they come and criticize me for this, that's important.
I don't think we're in line for criticism.
No. I agree, but that's why.
Their country, San Joaquin, 41. They actually have their.
So what you're saying is 30 is not outrageously high in any way.
I think it's good for a 7.25% discount rate.
Yeah.
Yours is a lot lower than.
Also, Graham, we don't think the wage inflator, in the coming year will be 3.25%.
So that ties along with the effect they have an inflation assumption of only 2, right?
Right.
Whereas your plan is 3. We'd like to see the inflation assumption coming down. We tend not to say, first of all, in terms of salaries, this is your long-term salary assumption, right? So that's always going to be in general systems, almost all systems use an assumption of something like their long-term inflation assumption, and then maybe plus a margin for productivity. And here you have a pretty small one. Some systems have something more like 50 or 75 basis points. But for public plans, I think a small one is reasonable.
Yeah,
so,
Mandy, what do you
think
it is?
It's even lower, I think. I would say probably around 3, the wage inflation.
So that's pretty close
so
to
that's
where
pretty
we
good.
Are.
That's
yeah.
what I'm saying.
Right.
So in reality, if that's a little lower, then the contribution rate is a little lower.
You might
lower,
have
right?
a little gain next
yeah.
year if salaries don't grow
so
by 3%.
That will offset that phase in that is
concerned about. So it feels like we're talking in circles.
Yeah, I just want to make one comment, though, about how the asset allocation that we're looking to alter a bit can also impact the county,
right.
what we're going to be looking at the county.
So they have those allocations, the other ones that you're talking about, those have a much higher expected real rate of return, right? And I think one of them, it was like 7.2%.
7.2, the other one was 7.3.
Right, yeah. And that's with a 2% inflation assumption. So, you know, you could drop your inflation assumption even further to be closer in line with your investment consultant, and that would reduce the cost.
But we'd have to implement the plan. And
yeah,
that's the year
way. You have to have some kind of indication that that's where you're going to go, which is, I think, why Rick's saying, which you took a good action this year to make a reasonable assumption that we're, you know, that we're all comfortable with based on your current allocation. If things change and you go in a new direction with your asset allocation, I would probably not recommend increasing the 7.25. I would probably recommend reduce your inflation assumption, which will also, you know, which has a lowering impact on your contribution rate, because that's where they're already sort of aligned. Yeah. The one thing that we don't generally recommend is something like, you know what, you should drop your inflation assumption this year from 3.25 to 2.
Yeah.
It's just a huge change, and it can be really disruptive.
Yeah. And I'm not asking you to change. I'm just pointing out there's some cushion here.
Yeah. So we've made some reductions, and we've recast, and we asked the county what they thought, and they told us they'd like to smooth it.
The whole thing.
Yeah. So are we going to do anything about it today, or are we just talking around it?
If you decide that you want to smooth the whole thing, we don't have to do anything. Because the directive we gave him last time.
Okay.
It's only if you want to smooth in only the unfunded portion, then we would have to vote.
Okay. So we're good right now, everybody.
Yeah. In terms of my responsibility, in terms of, you know, we presented the phase in. Mm-hmm. Anytime we do something, the pay me now or pay me later always comes into effect, right? So I would be remiss if I didn't show you what the impact of phasing the contribution rates is going to be on contributions in future years. Okay, so this is where I said I'm gonna go downhill from here. Okay? What I have here is your projected contribution rate under the actuarial fantasy, right? That you're going to earn exactly 7.25% every year, and we know exactly when everyone is going to retire and so forth. So without any phase in, that contribution rate increased to 30.86, so around 30.9% of pay. Right? If we phase in the entire amount, which was the increase is 8.1. And we do it over a 3-year period. This is what the contribution rates look like. So instead of being 30.86, the contribution rate in the first year is about 25%. Right?
And so after 4 years, it's really close to what either way at the same.
Yep.
So, but look in the out years, what you give up, right? This is pay me later, this is pay me now. Under pay me now, your contribution rate in year 2019 is about 28.8. If it's pay me later, then it's 29.5. So it's about 0.7% of pay higher, and that 0.7% higher is for all of those future years, right? So it goes out the entire length of the 20-year amortization period. So by saving, you know, 5% of pay this year and 2.5% of pay the year after that, you are going to end up with a higher contribution rate in future years because pay me now or pay me later.
We kick the can down the road.
Which we do a lot. So what are you recommending to do?
I am not making a recommendation.
Well, I think this is what a partnership is about, though. We gave them the parameter. They said we want to do this.
Right.
They're on the hook to pay it. Yeah. I think it's into discussion. Yeah.
The county is on the hook no matter what happens.
Right.
So yeah. This is what we were expecting. Was to be phased.
Let me dig myself a deeper hole.
Okay. How many more grenades you got in your pocket?
I don't know what's gotten into it. 15, 16, I don't think it's been a great year so far. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No.
It's not been stellar.
I'm not correcting.
I don't think it's a bad thing to have some idea, which we can do using this model of what are your contribution rates look like in future years based on what we know about fiscal year 15, 16 so far. I don't know if you have, I have other plans that have asked me to model something like a 3 or 4% loss on a fiscal year basis. I don't know if that's where you stand. When I saw this rebalancing analysis, if I put a 4% loss in, it kind of got the market value, close to that $1.72 billion number. Does that sound?
You see what it looks like.
No, that sounds high.
That sounds.
That sounds too much, like too high of a loss.
Too high of a loss. Yeah. Okay. Well, if it's just zero, how about say zero since July 1st? This is what we're looking at. So if you look here, you know, you don't see anything this year. This it starts to account next year, but 27.8 goes up to 28.5, and then sort of the peak in 2020 is about 34% of pay versus 29.3.
But it really is pay later.
So that's.
So Jim, are you still on the board?
Yo, that's another question.
But based on board, it might be just till the end of the year. I don't know.
This still reflects the phase in of the
what you'd earn this fiscal year probably doesn't have much of an impact on the difference of the phase in.
It doesn't have any impact on the phase in. This is just on top of the phase.
You're going
on top of the assumption.
It's going to happen whether you like it or not. Right.
I agree with Professor. This is a partnership, and over the years we have established by non-anecdotal evidence that this is one of the best run 3-7 counties in California. So I think it closes the discussion also.
I mean, but if you want to continue to do the cool graphics, I mean, let's do a year where we had a 16% gain in the market.
Sure, you want to do that as next year?
Yeah, let's do next year.
Right.
So we feel better about ourselves at the end of the discussion.
There we go. We're right back where you are.
Yeah. So, and probably there's going to be some winners and some losers.
Be so
historically, it's been that way.
And we've done the simulation thing.
Right.
We do the simulation Monte Carlo.
So are we not going to have a motion?
It doesn't sound like his marching orders already included the scenarios we looked at.
Did anyone want to make a motion of any sort?
Unless we want to phase in only the unfunded liability, then we don't need a motion.
Did we see what that looked like?
Yes, we did. I make a motion that we move on.
Well, we don't need a motion
I like
to do
that one.
Do
yeah. Spring training calls.
You've got it.
I got a flight in the morning.
Are you really going to Arizona?
Another one?
Going back. I just got in yesterday.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good. Good exercise.
It's
exactly what you asked me to do.
Yeah.
Another Catholic.
Yeah.
Good.
Oh, it's one night.
I'll try to be green.
You have?
I mean, if Mandeep and Jim swallow it, I mean, that's all we can do.
Before we leave this item, though, Ed has one more thing.
Yeah, I'm sorry about this. The this was in response to Mandeep's request at the last meeting. We did risk parity on... in the materials behind tab 2, you have the historical returns, I think is what you had asked for. So I just want to make a point that you now have that. Nothing surprising about it. The only thing I would note is there is one line of zeros across the bottom for this blended index, and that is not accurate. I can provide you with the updated numbers, but it doesn't really change the picture. I think you'll see that across these strategies, you're getting the kind of risk return we talked about. We model it as a 7% expected return, and you can see what the strategies have done over the past 5, 7, and 10 years. It's not inconsistent with that, keeping in mind that 10 years included the 2008 pullback, and they still have positive returns there. That's all I have.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. So, Executive Director Administrative.
Okay, so this is 9A. This has to do with the SACRS 2016-2017 Board of Directors election. This is a discussion and action item. And we don't have a recommendation, but I'm going to turn this over to Kelly to have her explain what this is about.
This item was asked to be presented to you by the SACRS Board of Directors. They come to you every year with a proposed nomination. They just want to know if this they're giving you the opportunity to nominate anyone else for the ballot that will be before you next meeting in April before it goes to the business meeting in May. So this is just a request if this board would like to add anybody to the nomination. If not, the nominees will stand as it is. Each 37 Act has the opportunity to add somebody prior to it being presented.
We can nominate whoever didn't show up at the meeting today.
So the actual ballot will come out in April.
We're not sure Jason will even go.
So the actual ballot will come out in April, and if none of the 37 acts submit anybody, it'll look like what it does today.
And then we'll be asking you in April to vote how you want to vote on that, the delegate vote on that at SACRA's committee. We're required to do this.
They still do candidates from before, though, don't they?
These are, I think, very similar
candidates.
These are like super delegates.
Yeah, I've seen these being voted for.
So we don't, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't see what we
do. No, we're...
Unless Joan wants to be on their board or...
No, absolutely not.
Thank you.
Item 9B, Information Technology Solutions Project Update. Now I'll let Dawn Lee speak on this.
So this is your monthly update on what's going on with our ITSE project. And so this time we are going to report that we are slipping a little bit on our timeline. We're about a week or two behind on where we had planned to be with the requirements documents. This has happened due to the large volume of retirements we have here in March. We have brought on two new part-time staff that need to be trained. And and also the testing of an upgrade to the Munis payroll system for the retiree payroll. So everyone had other things that had to take priority to keep our regular function going. But this is not going to cause us a problem with our project. We did feel that it was worth taking the extra time to make sure that we get it right. We'd rather do it well than fast. So, but it's not a big delay in the process, and Linnea is we're in very close contact, so we think we will be just fine on the project. So everything is still moving forward, just a little bit slower this last couple of weeks than it has been in the past.
Okay. Item 9C, legislation update. This is an information item only, and Dawn Lee has this one as well.
This is something that you're probably already familiar with. This is what was discussed at the November SACRS. This is legislation that would allow for retirement systems from the 37 Act to be able to move forward with modernizing their structure without having to individually go to the legislature whenever every other year, whenever they're ready to make changes. They had to get things started just because of how the legislature works, and you have to get things started at a specific time. So SACRS did back this bill. They went out, they've got it started. However, this is an issue that is going to be addressed at the May SACRS conference this year, just as you were told before. And then they will assess at that point where the backing is on this, whether they have the support of the systems or not. If they don't, then this legislation can just be pulled or die. But if they do have it, then at least they have things in place to move forward.
So this is that same issue we brought to you a few months ago. You'll be asked to make a formal decision on it next month to let our voting delegate know how to vote on the operating independence.
This thing is 11 and a half pages of single space.
Yes.
Those of us that know how the legislature works, there's something in here we're going to hate, and we're not going to know it until it's too late. So I suggest everybody read this.
We will ask your name.
All 11 and a half pages.
What was our position last time?
Give us that.
No.
Yeah, our position was no last time.
Right. Pardon me?
Our position is no on it. The thing you're holding, our position has been no.
No, I'm not opposing it. I'm just saying that there could be something in here we really hate, and we don't know.
Just so you understand, at this stage, our position has been no.
Yeah, I'm saying be careful.
You've read it, right, John? You've read it.
I've read 90% of it. I got bored about three quarters of the way through.
I'll cover the other 10.
All right. You read the last three pages, okay?
And I believe the entire document was sent out to all board members. It came in an email from Rick. It was forwarded from Mr. Stensfred. And they have a white paper, they have a shortened version, and then they have the full document there all attached to the email.
It's been amended, though.
Again, already?
since Rick sent it out?
Yes.
We can check that and resend it out if it has been amended. I'll check the date on the email.
Well, I haven't got anything else from Richard, so.
The committee analysis on these bills is pretty straightforward.
This doesn't say when it was amended, but it did on the banner. It did say there was an amendment.
I'll double check it. If it's been amended since the email went out, we'll send it out.
Send the most current.
All right.
Strategic Planning Committee.
Item 10A, discussion and action item. And I will let Kathy speak to this.
Okay, the committee met today prior to the beginning of this meeting. And as you recall, about 3.5 years ago, this board met and went through a full day workshop to determine the 4 strategic objectives that they approved. And a lot of work has been done. The staff came back with action plans after the objectives were set. About 90% of those action plans have been finished. But after reviewing these objectives and talking to the committee has decided that these objectives are still very valid to our business model, and that staff will be bringing back additional action items to take this forward, rather than have a whole another full day workshop and hire a consultant. We feel that what we have, and the committee has approved that, to continue working with the current action plan with new action items. And those staff will be bringing those back to committee in the next couple of months to take us forward into the next few years.
Make a motion to accept the Strategic Planning Committee's recommendation.
Yeah, second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries.
No
closed session today?
No.
Then I think that's it. I was.
Everybody jumps on you. Sorry.
Nothing for me.
I think that's it. We'll go to members.
Good idea.
I would like this group to reconsider the 1 o'clock starting time and maybe suggest we start at 1:30 instead. We're going to be here till close to 5 o'clock anyway. But it's too close to the lunch hour. It's just...
Is that something you'd like us to bring back? Let me remind you that what the board's decision was in November of last year was to go to this schedule and then relook at it again in November of this year, decide whether they want to continue to do it this way. But
I think we ought to look at it sooner.
Changing things up right now.
Having been late today, I have to second what she says. It's hard for me to make meetings here.
What is the pleasure of the board?
Let's add it to the agenda.
I have comments to make about that, too.
Okay, the only thing I would ask you is that we can put it on the agenda, but to what extent are types of changes are really? Is it just
looking
a simple
1:30?
1 to 1:30 and that's it?
Yeah, that'd be fine. They give
anything
me enough time.
Else that you want us to consider?
I do. You know, I've never, we're still in the forum, so Jeff's
I don't have anything.
I've never been happy with the change in the week. You know, we don't get these flash reports till it's a month late now, and I have StanCog meeting, you know, in an hour. I got to be there, and it puts a lot of meetings on me from this thing. Now, combining 2 meetings into one makes this a really long meeting, and it puts it at the same time StanCog, you know. I can't go to the Equal Rights Commission's meeting because they conflict with this.
Is there a better day?
For me, well, I don't know why we ever changed it from the fourth week to the third. I don't remember the reason for that, but this creates, you know, problems for me.
Fourth week, it conflicts dramatically with the holidays in November and December. That was one issue that we talked about. The third week was, the reason we chose third week was because it was the week that didn't interfere with Sackers, which I don't.
Yeah, but I think it's also because we were meeting the second and the fourth.
Rick, I think we should just stop talking about it.
Yeah, just agenda items.
Okay, because you can't look at everything.
The weekend.
So everything's on the table there.
Okay.
And also 1 or 2 times a month, consider going back.
I think let's just open it up and talk
perfect.
About it.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Because you go any farther down, you're out of your agenda. You know.
Mike?
I just wanted to, Graham's not here, but I just wanted to mention that Graham did a couple presentations at Calipers that were excellent presentations. Did a good job. And then, of course, I just want to wish everybody a happy St. Patrick's Day. And that's all I have.
Gordon?
Just remember to pay your property tax by the 11th. You got an extra day.
Yeah. Mandy?
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to attend the California Association of Public Retirement Systems training about a week ago. And I found it so relevant to the topic we discussed. I've never gone to a training that's so much relevant.
Which one was this? The
Calipers.
One
Calipers.
It was like asset allocation, you know, your discount rates, all of the stuff that I hear. That was pretty helpful.
Calipers?
Yes, yeah. The General Assembly.
Yeah, yep. It was a good meeting.
Mike?
I have nothing.
I only have a reminder about the SACRS conference coming up in May, since we will probably need delegates soon, and we'll have another item next month. Just remember those dates and let me know if anyone is interested in attending.
It's the first week?
They are May 10th through the 13th in Costa Mesa. If you haven't turned in your 700 forms, a reminder to get those to me. I'll be going through them later on this week, and I'll get with you if you haven't.
I'll do the first.
I have.
I took mine to the clerk's office yesterday.
Can you give us a copy?
No, but I can.
Yeah, we'll have to have a copy.
All right.
We're the mandated reporter for this entity.
And we are.
Well, mine
so just a reminder, but I'll be going through them later this week. So if you haven't, I'll be calling you.
He's the first.
Okay, I will follow up with what Mandy said. The General Assembly was a pretty darn good conference. They pack a whole lot into about 2 days worth of information. So I find that refreshing, because if I'm there, I don't want my time to be wasted. So I thought it was a good conference. They did a good job with it. Also, the good news is we are actually going for open to RFP on our vacant space on March 17th. So they're actually going to put the RFP out for us. So we are finally moving forward. So I just wanted to share
that's for the new chamber.
Pardon?
For the new chamber?
Yes. For, well, finish the walls, and then we have to do the chamber part. But yes, to get the walls finally finished so that we can move forward.
And rebalance.
Damn it.
Yeah, rebalance the air conditioning.
Doesn't get lost in the trash.
That's it.
Done? Then I think we're adjourned.
Okay.